Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
I heard y'all ain't hitting in North Carolina.
Today we're going to be talking about some of the biggest stories here in the Triad. And up first, a violent arrest by police in Greensboro testing North Carolina's 2016 law on the release of police body cam footage. The mother of 15-year-old Jose Charles says police choked her son without provocation at a 4th of July party. She wants the public to see the police tape of that incident. Police charged Charles with attacking an officer, among other crimes. Meanwhile, the lines have been drawn and then redrawn in Greensboro. A federal judge struck down the General Assembly's redistricting law for the Greensboro City Council. The judge deemed the new districts unconstitutional. Here to talk about those stories and more are Jordan Green, who is the senior editor for the Triad City Beat. Welcome back, Jordan.
Thank you.
And Danielle Battaglia is a court reporter with the Greensboro News and Record. Hello, Danielle.
Thank you.
Jordan, let me start with this first story we talked about. Jose Charles, this takes us back to July, the arrest of a 15-year-old here in Greensboro, captured on body cam, and now his mother would like the release of that footage. Tell us the story.
As you mentioned, there is a violent encounter between this 15-year-old and the Greensboro police at the Fun Fourth Festival at Center City Park on July 4th. So I have to get into a little bit of detail here. The mother of Jose, Tamara Figueroa, watched the video, and her account is that she had some of her other children with her, and she took them to the bathroom and left her son outside, and he got into an altercation with a large group of kids. There had been some friction on Facebook, and So after the fight, all the other kids ran away, and the police approached Jose. He had a cut above his eye, and the police officer asked him if he was involved in the fight, and Jose was very agitated, and he said, I've been jumped N-word. It unfortunately escalated from there, leading to... Jose's mother says that a police officer picked him up and slammed him down in a suplex move. The police report that I read describes that as the officer placing the 15-year-old on the ground.
So the official report uses the word place. His mother says slammed. Okay.
Right. The police report does say that blood profusely came out of his forehead as a result of that maneuver. So there's a lot of yelling and struggling, and the police, to try to avoid public kind of uproar, they moved the situation or moved Jose to a parking deck across, or an alley next to a parking deck across the street from the park. And it was at that point that Jose was saying that he couldn't breathe, and his mother found him there, and Jose ended up getting charged with assault on an officer, and the basis of that was that he spat blood in the direction of an officer, and it some of it got on his face. And his mother says that, this blood from his forehead flowed into his mouth, and he was trying to clear his mouth. So there wasn't a malicious kind of thing. There were several other charges, including disorderly conduct and resisting arrest. So to bring it up to the present, Jose has also been, since then, has been diagnosed with schizo-disaffective disorder and post-traumatic stress. He is facing charges for, he's gotten into some trouble since then as well. And so he's still facing this charge of assault on an officer. And his mother would like the police video to be public.
So she has seen, and again, we'll get into the new 2016 law that restricts the release of body cam, but family members are allowed to see it.
Yeah, that's
she's
right.
She's seen it.
That's right.
Yeah.
She would like to have it released publicly. That's not allowed under the law, which she has requested, and the city council, Greensboro City Council, has agreed on a 5-4 vote to review the video after a very cumbersome citizen review process is completed. And meanwhile, I guess just to wrap this up, there is pressure for Jose to plead guilty to these charges, which could have very significant impacts on his life.
How does the law affect what the Greensboro City Council is doing? In other words, as I understand the law, the video from a police cam can be released to the public, generally speaking via the media, but to the public one way or another, if a judge rules in favor. So you'd have to take the request to a judge. The judge would have to say it's okay, and then whatever that public is would then have access to the video cam, but not before. It's not up to the police. What about the city council? Can they ask for it and get it, or do they have to go through a judge too?
I stand to be corrected on this if I'm wrong, but I believe that the city council has the right, as the governing body overseeing the police, to review the video in private. And I'm actually not sure whether they're allowed to make characterizations or
what would happen afterwards. Yeah. So then the question is, but he has a trial date coming up, and as you say, they're really pressuring him to plead guilty before this thing sees the light of day. Their process wouldn't allow even them to see it before his trial date, his current trial date, as I understand it, that they've got a process that they'd have to go through, and his trial date might come up before they actually get to screen it.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, I think that I think the Tamara Figueroa would like the city council to see it as soon as possible so that the city council can say to the DA, this charge is not validated based on the video that we have seen.
And this is precisely what critics were critical of in the new law that restricts the release of body cam footage, because it just casts more suspicion on the police because you haven't allowed the public to see what is now a controversial arrest. The evidence exists. The public can make its own decision and its own judgment. And now, of course, this casts the Greensboro police, once again, are under suspicion.
Yeah, I think that's a perfect way to sum it up.
Yeah. So, well, we'll see. So what's the next step? Are there any next points or turning points in this for the next date?
Yeah, well, Jose faces trial in early May. And So meanwhile, before the city council can review the video, the citizens review board process has to play out. The citizen review board has actually said that they do not agree with the police internal investigation, which cleared themselves of wrongdoing and an accusation of excessive force. So the city council then asked the chief to respond to the citizen review board's concerns, and if the citizen review board still doesn't agree with the police, then it can be appealed up to the city manager. So it's a very cumbersome and process with many steps.
No matter where I'm at, I got crack. Started from the trap, now I rap. Tell 'em, no matter where I'm at, I got crack. I got Krenag, yeah, I got Krenag. Got that Krenag, yeah, I got Krenag. Started from the trap, now I rap. No matter where I'm at, I got crack.
If you think it's a big deal that Donald Trump has changed course from Barack Obama by bringing back the war on Syria, just wait till you hear how he wants to bring back the war on drugs. I mentioned this briefly yesterday, but we're making it our lead conversation today because of the vast implications of a Washington Post story over the weekend by their justice correspondent, Sari Horowitz, a past Pulitzer Prize winner for investigative reporting. While criminal justice reform and an end to mass incarceration have been goals of Obama and, frankly, much of the country in both parties, Attorney General Jeff Sessions is beginning to revert to a 1980s and 1990s-style war on drugs, and he has appointed a true believer in that reversion to a top deputy job to implement it. That deputy is Stephen Cook, who was an assistant U.S. attorney. Here is a video of Stephen Cook that Sari included in her Washington Post story. This is a 30-second excerpt.
What we did beginning in 1985 or along in there is put these laws to work. And what we did by putting them to work is we started filling the federal prisons, not state prisons, federal prisons, with the worst of the worst. And what happened is exactly what Congress said they wanted to happen, and that is violent crime began in 1991, began to turn around. By 2014, we'd cut it in half. That's what the system is doing, and it's designed to do, and it's working exactly as it is.
And about the recent reforms aimed at reversing mass incarceration?
As a result of some of the reforms that we've seen across the country, we've seen violent crime spiraling up across the country.
Stephen Cook. Why are they all named Stephen these days? Stephen Bannon, Stephen Miller, Stephen Cook. Steve Cook in September, now a top appointee for a drug policy of Attorney General Jeff Sessions. And with that, we welcome Washington Post Justice Correspondent Sari Horowitz. And one of the sources in her story, Inamai Chettiar, forgive me, Director of the Justice Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. Welcome to both of you to WNYC.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning.
Sari, Jeff Sessions is a crusader for mass incarceration?
Well, Brian, he wouldn't say that. He wouldn't put it that way. He has not actually issued a specific formal policy change on violent crime. But what we're hearing him talk about is the need to crack down on crime and drug use. And what that means is more arrests and more people in prison. Since he became Attorney General in February, he has given several speeches, and we're going to hear another speech today. He's on the southwest border in Nogales, Arizona, and he'll be talking about crime and immigration. But he's been in Richmond, he's been in St. Louis, and he's issued several memos to his U.S. attorneys across the country saying that he believes that the rise in crime in several cities is a sign of something more dangerous to come. And he wants his prosecutors to begin using every tool they can to bring changes.
Inamai, you're quoted in Sari's article saying Congress was close to passing a criminal justice reform bill, and Sessions came in at the last minute and torpedoed it. It would have given judges more discretion to impose shorter sentences on drug felons if they thought those sentences were warranted, and made retroactively, or would have retroactively, smooth the disparities between crack and powder cocaine crimes, which resulted in racial disparities in prison time, as we all know. How did Sessions kill that bill?
So this was a bill called the Sentencing Reform and Corrections Act that had been introduced the year earlier. And in January of 2016, Sessions and Tom Cotton, actually along with Steve Cook, came in and started calling the bill a criminal leniency bill, even though it was championed by people in his own party, including Chuck Grassley and Senator Lee and Paul Ryan. And so he firmly placed himself at the far right of his own party, which is interesting. And what they were able to successfully do is to show that it would cause a split in the party to bring the bill to a vote. And so McConnell did not.
Sari, you note in the article that that bill was the rare Washington creature that had the support of both the NAACP and the Koch brothers. Maybe now we know why they're called the Koch brothers. No, I'm kidding. But where was the common ground ideologically or interest-wise between the NAACP and the Koch brothers on this?
They both agreed with the Obama administration that the war on drugs had gone too far, that sentencing reform advocates and lawmakers on both sides of the aisle, as both of you just said, felt that we'd gone too far. The United States at this point was incarcerating people at a higher rate than any other country. This is what you spoke about, mass incarceration. The United States, we've heard the statistics over and over, but they have 5% of the world's population, and we jail 25% of the world's prisoners. And there was a feeling, a strong feeling, by Republicans, Democrats, the Koch brothers, the NAACP, the Obama administration, that we needed to make the punishment fit the crime. This was also very expensive. It's costing the United States $80 billion a year. And if you look at what happened since the beginning of the drug war in the 1980s, the U.S. prison and jail population, this is state and federal prisons, more than quadrupled from 500,000 in 1980 to 2.2 million in 2015. And the prisons became filled with mostly people of color, actually mostly black men, who had lengthy sentences, 10, 20 years, sometimes life without parole, for a first-time drug offense.
Do we know if President Trump took a position or an interest in this personally? Because what you're describing in Congress, Sari, is pretty extraordinary. If you had Chuck Grassley, who's the head of the Senate Judiciary Committee, for people who don't follow closely, he was just in the news a lot for spearheading the Gorsuch hearings. Chuck Grassley, head of the Judiciary Committee, obviously a Republican. Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan. That's an unusual coalition with the Democrats and the criminal justice reform advocates. So Sessions had the power to come in here and convince Mitch McConnell not even to bring it up for a vote, as Inamai was describing before. Do you know if the president took a personal interest?
He did. President Trump, when he was on the campaign trail, his views very much mirror the views of Attorney General Jeff Sessions. We've heard him talk about American carnage and crime in the United States. He opposed President Obama's clemency effort, and talked about it on the campaign trail, and talked about these bad dudes who are going to get out of prison. So we know that his views mirror his attorney general's views.
And Inamai, that was something that was somewhat well reported, but maybe with the transition to Trump, not something that so many people saw in the news. There was a lot of clemency at the last minute by Obama, specifically for people in federal prisons who he felt were victims of excessive sentences under the old mass incarceration policies, right?
Yeah, I think Trump's views are a little bit unclear. So obviously he's appointed Jeff Sessions, who is set to bring back a new war on drugs. But some of Trump's statements in the past have actually supported reducing prison time for marijuana. And most recently, actually last week, he dispatched Jared Kushner to go and speak with Senators Grassley and Lee and Durbin about the Sentencing Reform and Corrections Act.
Huh.
And so I think it's unclear where Trump lies personally. I don't know how much that matters at all.
With us, Inamai Chettier, Director of the Justice Program at the Brennan Center for Justice, and Washington Post Justice Correspondent Sari Horowitz, who had that article. It's been one of the most read on the Washington Post website for a number of days now, about Jeff Sessions taking steps to bring back a 1980s and 90s style war on drugs. Listeners, any comments, questions, stories? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Inamai, in the Steve Cook soundbite that we played, this deputy of Sessions, who's a big hawk on this issue, Cook describes the approach to more incarceration that started in the mid-'80s as a good thing. We filled the prisons and the streets got safer. But he didn't describe it as locking away every kid caught with simple possession, say. He used the words worst of the worst. We locked up the worst of the worst, meaning violent criminals, I think. So how much of what we think of as mass incarceration could have come from that?
So I think there's two issues with what he said. One, there's been comprehensive research showing that incarceration was not the major contributor to bringing down crime. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, Cook has said that he believes that all drug crimes are inherently violent. So that means if they're going after what they consider violent crimes, it likely includes drug offenders.
Huh. And maybe how much can Sessions even bring back the era of mass incarceration, Sari, even if he wants to? Aren't most criminal prisoners convicted on state and local crimes rather than federal ones. Anybody who's sat on a jury, you know, knows basically you usually get brought into your county courtroom for the local crimes that are, you know, including most drug crimes, which are state charges. So how much can he bring back an era of mass incarceration at the federal level?
Right. Well, what he can do is reverse federal charging policy. Eric Holder, former attorney general in 2013, announced a sweeping new policy. He called it Smart on Crime. And he told his prosecutors to stop charging low-level, nonviolent drunk offenders with offenses that would impose these severe, these harsh prison sentences known as mandatory minimums. And I actually worked on a series last year where I went to, 2 years ago, where I went to prisons, federal prisons, every month to interview people who were in there under mandatory minimums. And one case I wrote about a woman named Sharonda Jones in Texas, a low-level drug offender who was not involved in any violence. And she was sentenced to life in prison without parole for her first drug offense. Now, President Obama eventually released her under his clemency program, and he eventually released more than 1,700 other drug offenders with harsh sentences. He released them early. But I met so many people. Weldon Angelos, another celebrated case, who received 50-plus years in prison for three times he an undercover agent bought marijuana from him. I mean, these sentences, these were not necessarily the worst of the worst. These were low-level drug offenders.
Let's take a phone call. Dominique in the Bronx. You're on WNYC. Hi, Dominique.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
Good. Thank you for calling.
So I'm just listening, and I'm in complete awe, and I'm baffled by what I'm hearing. To me, the question that comes to mind is, what does this mean for the Black community, for the African American community that was severely affected by those policies back in the 80s and the 90s? To me, it seems like all of the retrospective clarity and information that we have today on how damaging those policies were to some communities, specifically the African American and Black communities. What does that exactly mean? Like, does that mean that he believes that those policies were successful? You know, because we know exactly how they affected the Black community so severely.
NMI?
Sure. I think that likely what the scariest thing is about what Trump and Sessions are saying is bringing back the tough on crime rhetoric. And so even if they don't have power at the federal level to bring back statewide mass incarceration, it's really changed the politics on the issue, and it makes it seem like it's less of a bipartisan issue. And so one of my fears is that a lot of these reforms that are happening at the state level to reduce prison populations will actually see some setbacks there, given the kind of national rhetoric that's come back.
And Dominique asks about impact on the Black community in particular. One of the ways that I think race figures into this is how the white establishment views Black drug users compared to white drug users. Black drug users are seen as more threatening criminals who need punishment. White drug users are seen more as people who have a health problem and need help. And I actually want to run part of a commercial that's currently running on TV with Chris Christie, the governor of New Jersey, who's recently been appointed the sort of fight the opioid addiction epidemic czar by President Trump. And note that he doesn't call for incarceration here, but he calls for people to have a second chance.
New Jerseyans with drug addiction deserve a second chance. New Jersey is making it easier to find treatment. Introducing 1-844-REACH-NJ and reachnj.gov. One number, one website, a clear path to help. Reach out and help the many lives affected by this awful disease. Don't suffer. Don't wait. Help is within reach.
Boy, talk about mixed messages. Sari, what do you think of the racial implications here? I mean, these days, opioid addiction is associated, maybe stereotypically, but associated with being white and rural. And Sessions is already a questionable character to so many people because of his history of racial remarks and prosecutions back in the 1980s when he was a U.S. attorney. Here we are with that kind of Chris Christie spot, pretty much on behalf of the president, and yet Sessions going this other way.
You know, you're right. This is a very different approach in terms of rhetoric. And I remember in the 1980s, I was covering the police department in D.C. and how the police would have these huge sweeps in African-American neighborhoods and, you know, just arrest hundreds of black men. There are definite racial implications in the rhetoric that we're hearing now.
She's my friends, but I'm in France.
One of the biggest Chinatowns in Europe is in Paris, and recently the Chinese community there has gone through something that may sound familiar to Americans, protests against police violence, specifically the fatal shooting by police of a Chinese man named Liu Xiaoyao in his own home. Police claim it was self-defense, but many Chinese in Paris accuse the police of bias against their community. Doan Bui is a reporter for Le Nouvel Observateur in Paris.
The family says that he was shot without doing anything. He was just, you know, cooking, and he had scissors on his hand because he was preparing a fish. And the police says that the man has attacked them so that they had to shoot him down to defend themselves. But the thing is, we had the first demonstration in front of the police station because a lot of the people from the Chinese community had heard about this story and thought that what happened was really unfair. So they wanted to show their protest and show their anger. It's the first time I've seen such an anger in the Chinese community.
I know the Paris police have had a really tense relationship with Arab and African emigres in the suburbs, but what is the reputation of the Paris police in Chinatown?
It's kind of difficult because for the past years, the Chinese community has been targeted by a lot of aggressions and robberies because there is this saying that Chinese people have a lot of money. You know, they run restaurants and they have a lot of cash on them. And they had the feeling that the police didn't do enough to protect them. So the Chinese community has been protesting against those aggressions for a long time.
So I'm curious if you're actually seeing this kind of generational divide in the protests. Like, are the demands of the younger generation different from the older generation of Chinese?
Yeah, the younger generation is very different from their parents because they want to be heard. And when they are angry, they want to show it. And their parents wanted to be more invisible. They didn't want to be noticed, and they want to be troubles.
Yeah, with this fluency in activism, is France kind of surprised to learn about this large Chinese community?
Yeah, totally. I would say France is very surprised with this demonstration because there is this cliché, I guess, about the Asian community, which is supposed to be a model minority, very quiet and never, you know, opposing the authorities. And this time we have seen fights against the police, which was very, very unusual.
What do you think makes this time different?
This time is different because the person who has been shot, Liu Xiaoyao, he was 56. It's true that he was Chinese. He didn't have French nationality, but he has been living in France for 20 years. And he has five children, and the five children, they are born in France, and they are French. So to me, it's a French family. And I was very surprised to see the media dealing with this story as if the story was, you know, only a story concerning a Chinese guy. And right now, the young generation who is born in France, they really are fed up with this, you know, this invisibility. They don't want to be, you know, the model minority or whatever. They just want to be French. Asian French, but French.
What about solidarity with the Chinese protesters from other immigrant and minority groups? Is that happening?
Unfortunately, this demonstration we've seen has been very, very Chinese. And I think it's something the younger generation is regretting, but maybe also because before they have not been that active also on, you know, on this anti-racist movement and so on. So maybe they will, you know, learn to earn their place.
I'd like you to tell us what kind of impact you think this is going to have on the upcoming elections in France, where Marine Le Pen is currently leading, she being on the far right.
We have this word in France, which is le vivre ensemble, which means we have to live together. And it's the idea and also this dream that all the communities can live together peacefully and, you know, learn from each other. But even if you are French from another country, you are not able to mix with the French Republic. And when they see young Asian guys, you know, demonstrating and breaking stuff. They say, oh, okay, those guys, they are like the others. So the rise of Marine Le Pen has showed that a lot of people right now are doubting that le vivre ensemble, living together, is still possible.
Reporter Doane Bouy with Le Nouvel Observateur in Paris. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
I don't think you really want to go to South Africa.
Why not?
Because you're black.
You are. He is.
Of course I'm black. That's why I want to go to South Africa. To join up with my oppressed brothers. To take up the struggle against the tyranny of the racist, fascist, white minority regime.
Fascist, white regime.
One man, one vote.
One man, one vote.
Free South Africa, you dumb son of a bitch.
We start with matters referring to police stations. And if you were listening last week, you might have heard John Matham speaking to the Muizenberg ward councillor, Amy Kuhl, about the new police station, or super police station, they're calling it, that Muizenberg is due to get at a cost of 100 million rand. And you might have heard that councillor saying, look, our police station does indeed need an upgrade, but it doesn't warrant that amount of money being spent, and it doesn't warrant that money being spent there. There are so many other areas needing upgrades or even just needing a basic police station. For example, Vreeghond, just a couple of kilometers away. Today's conversation is really a spin-off from that one, because there is a second element to this conversation, and that is, if 100 million rand is being spent on Muizenberg, where's that money being redirected from? Or rather, what would that money have been spent on elsewhere in the city? Because it would appear that there has been backtracking on previous assurances that an additional police station would be built in Khayelitsha, where we know the murder rate ranks as one of the worst in the country. Cast your minds back to 2014, when our former provincial police commissioner, Arno Lemoore, told the Khayelitsha Commission of Inquiry that a new police station would be built in the Makaza informal settlement. It's emerged now that National Department of Public Works says it hasn't received any other requests to expand police stations in Cape Town, and that other than that 100 million rand being set aside for the upgrade at Muizenberg. What is going on? They're saying that is the only one on the police's capital works priority list in this province. Social Justice Coalition has added its voice to this conversation and has vowed to oppose the construction in Muizenberg. I have their head of safety and justice program, Chumile Sali, on the line with us now. Chumile, thank you so much for making time for us this afternoon and welcome to the show.
Good afternoon and thank you for inviting us.
Chumile, what is the problem? Why is the Social Justice Coalition opposing the revamp in Muizenberg?
Likening what is going to happen in Muizenberg to the same corruption scandal that happened in Kandla, where the house of the president was built using taxpayers' money. It doesn't make sense to build a 100 million police station in a white, safer community whilst there's a need for police stations in areas like Vreeghond, which is next to Muizenberg, in Masipumelele, Khayelitsha, Nyanga, Krefondin, and many other communities. As the SJC, we've been advocating for the reallocation of police resources, because our argument is that there are more police resources deployed to areas where there is no need. So this situation, it confirms our suspicion that South African police services continue to serve only white communities. 100 million police station, a 5 million police station would be sufficient. And now SAFs and Public Works are going to spend 100 million to build or to upgrade one police station in an area which has enough police resources, in an area with not quite a high number of violent crimes.
So the issue, of course, is saying why so much money on an area that already has an existing police station and doesn't have as high a crime level as some areas which don't have enough police resources. Are you specifically aware of the promises made around Makaza and a police station that should be built in that area? And are you aware of what's happened to that plan? That was 2014, Arno Lemoore suggested that it was going to happen. Do you know when it was taken off the table?
Yes, last year, the South African Police Services, they published their plans for the next 5 years. And as far as we are aware, Makaza police station is one of the police stations that will be built in the Western Cape. And the plan was that this year, 2017, there will be a planning and a design phase. And by early 2019, the construction of the police station is going to start. So we are shocked to hear that the public works says that they have not received any information from the South African Police Services. It therefore means that we are being undermined as the residents of Khayelitsha. Same wise, when you go to Nyanga, Nyanga is one of the police stations with less police resources, and yet Nyanga is the major capital of South Africa. We and Nyanga residents have been promised that a second police station will be built in Samora Machel. That promise was made in 2005. We are now in 2017, and still there's no police station, and yet SARS saw it fit, sees it fit to build a police station in an area where there's no need for another police station. And there are communities that need police stations, like Fairhold, like Masipumelelo, for example. You remember that in 2015, there was a violent protest in Masipumelelo, residents demanding a police station in their community.
Yes.
Because they have to travel to Ocean View to access police services. And yet, SARS does not build a police station in Masipumelelo.
You were listening there to Chumile Sali, head of the Safety and Justice Program at the Social Justice Coalition. That I can tell you that protest by the Social Justice Coalition tomorrow is between 11 and 1, and it's happening outside the SAPS provincial offices in Greenpoint.
Artificial intelligence, known as AI, is used by everybody from Facebook to the FBI. It's based on algorithms, sets of instructions in computer code. At the moment, these algorithms determine what you see online and how you see it. But some people are worried they are also delivering racist messages. Zoe Kleinman reports.
This can be what happens when algorithms do the right job, but in the wrong way.
If you Google thug, you tend to get page after page of black faces. But if you Google hand or baby, you get white hands and white babies.
There's been a number of examples of potential problems with bias in criminal justice.
The problem was that as I was working on the project, the computer vision software I was using didn't detect my face consistently. And I found wearing a white mask, because I have very dark skin, made it easier for the system to work.
Joy Bolambuini is a computer science student in the US. She launched the Algorithmic Justice League after repeatedly finding that facial recognition software did not recognise her face. I asked her why algorithms seem to have issues with ethnicity.
I honestly think a huge part of the problem is who's currently creating technology. Because a lack of diversity with the creators of technology means it's harder to identify issues when they come up. If you test your system on people who look like you and it works fine, you're never going to know that there's a problem.
The question is, what can we do about it? Suresh Venkata Subramanian is an associate professor at the University of Utah School of Computing.
Let's collect data in a better, more diverse way. Let's think harder about what kind of data we're collecting and what kind of biases might show up. Let's try to build systems that explain to us what they're doing as they make decisions, so we can see if the explanations are sound and make sense. Let's try to talk about, policy prescriptions that might help, or let's try to find better ways to ask questions of vendors who provide the software, sort of best practices, basically, so that we understand exactly how these systems are working and how they might make their decisions.
Cambridge University computer engineering student Agnes Cameron, who led a packed discussion at the university's recent science festival, believes the issue is not going to go away.
Everything we do relies on artificially intelligent systems, racist or not, and there's no real way that that's going to change. And so unless we change the systems that we are using or have a very big conversation about how we should use the systems that we are using, we're going to see these kind of biases being confirmed and being fed back into systems that are already existing and where they are already being created.
And that report was by Zoe Kleinman.
College don't mean shit. Y'all niggas, and you gonna be niggas forever, just like us, niggas.
Viral and disturbing video circulating on social media claims to show a Memphis couple making explicit racist remarks while on vacation in Turks and Caicos.
You're a
you dumb.
A story from LiveLeak.com identifies the couple as a woman who used to work for the Greater Memphis Chamber of Commerce and the man who is the CFO/COO of Tobacco Superstores Incorporated in Arkansas. Our chief investigative reporter, Jim Spiewak, has been working this story all day. Jim, what did you find out? This story seems to have a lot of layers.
It certainly does, Daryl. The video is a taped phone call that a Caribbean website says took place between restaurant staffers there and a couple visiting from Memphis. What is so controversial about it, the language the couple uses throughout the entire call. I counted the N-word was used 24 times by the woman believed to be right here from Memphis. This explosive 4.5-minute video shows a picture of what appears to be Lauren Loeb's phone. It features a picture of her and her fiance Joe Mariella in some very graphic language.
This is actually fun for us. It's going to be hell for you.
Caribbean news agency Magnetic Media reported the couple called Mango Reef Restaurant because they thought the woman's cell phone had been stolen when they were there. The callers began making racist comments to the staff, so the staff hit record.
I want my wife's phone back.
You don't have your phone, buddy.
Somebody does.
Hey, you're still That's all that matters.
Somebody does.
This sucks for you.
The call even has a death threat.
Where are you staying? I want to find you, and I want to kick your right now. Where are you staying?
I'll cut your throat.
The staff claim they later found the phone in a menu while they were setting up for dinner, and it was then returned to the couple. An attorney representing both Loeb and Marielle said in a statement, Miss Loeb's phone was stolen while she and her husband were at the restaurant in Turks and Caicos. She asked her online friends to negatively review the restaurant. They've now attempted to defame Miss Loeb and her husband. The conversation that is being claimed to occur is faked in many respects, as neither of them would use the terms or speak in the manner portrayed. So one question still remaining is if Lauren Loeb is related to the family who owns Loeb Properties. The company itself took to social media today saying, in part, quote, the individuals involved are in no way associated with Loeb Properties. Lauren Loeb was referred to as working for the Memphis Chamber of Commerce. The chamber acknowledged she used to work there, but left last month. Both of their statements in full are on our website, fox13memphis.com. And tonight at 6, a quick scrubbing of the internet that erased much of the digital trail on both of the people involved at the center of this story.
Now we do have the, thank you, Jim, we have the full unedited recording of that racist rant. If you would like to watch it and listen for yourself, again, we'll warn you, it is graphic. It's also right there with the original news report of that incident. All you have to do is go to our website, log on to fox13memphis.com.
They see me rolling, they hating, patrolling and trying to catch me riding dirty, 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 trying to catch me riding dirty. My music's so loud, I'm swinging, they hoping that they gon' catch me riding dirty.
If you own a car or drive one regularly, then you probably know this. Car insurance costs more for some drivers than for others. For example, women generally pay less than men. Married men generally pay less than single men. Insurance companies say that the price differences are due to the level of risk involved in insuring a driver. According to their algorithms, the people who pay less for car insurance do so because they have a lower risk of having accidents. But a new study by Consumer Reports and ProPublica says that on average, drivers who live in white neighborhoods pay far less for car insurance than drivers who live in predominantly non-white neighborhoods, price gaps that are larger than risk alone can account for, in some cases as much as 30%. Here to tell us more about all this is ProPublica reporter Julia Angwin, who co-authored this study, and she's with us now. Julia, thanks so much for speaking with us.
It's great to be here.
Try to walk me through the research here, because I'm sure that people have many, many questions. Now, your research focused on a particular profile of a customer, a 30-year-old woman with a safe driving history. Why this particular customer?
What we wanted to do was remove all the factors that insurers use other than geography. So they use all sorts of factors about your driving record and your credit history sometimes and how many miles you drive, what kind of car you have. And that's part of the calculation of rates. So we asked for quotes for this one woman in all zip codes across America. And then what we did was looked at the differences and compared them to the true risk, as far as we could tell, of what insurers really were suffering in terms of losses in those zip codes. So what we found was basically that if you took a apples to apples, a whiter neighborhood and a more minority neighborhood, and said these are two that insurers on average have paid out the same amount in losses per car over the last 5 years, why are the premiums 30% higher in the minority neighborhood than in the white neighborhood? And so what we did was we looked at each of these two kind of comparable neighborhoods across a whole state, and then we came up with an average disparity. So on average, for instance, the disparity between a minority neighborhood and non-minority neighborhood for GEICO in Chicago was about 18%.
The California Department of Insurance did respond, though. They criticized the approach, saying that, quote, the study's flawed methodology results in a flawed conclusion. How do you respond to that?
So what California actually brought us like a slightly more specific objection, which is a fair one. So they said, look, you took all the insurers' payouts per zip code on average and compared that as your baseline for what is risk. But each different insurer may have a different rate of losses. That's true, but we can't see that number. However, we did find there was one company nationwide in California that for whatever reason actually filed its internal losses per zip code in one of their rate filings with the insurance commission. In that one case, we could test that assumption, and we found that the disparities between minority neighborhoods and non-minority neighborhoods of the same risk, when you looked at Nationwide's own actual risk, the disparities were higher than what we had found when we did it the other way.
Is there any explanation for this that makes sense?
The one thing that kind of sticks out to me is that consistently, when you looked at the comparison between premium and the true risk, you saw that in predominantly minority neighborhoods, as the risk increased, the premiums increased. And it was pretty much a linear relationship like you would expect. What we saw was in the whiter neighborhoods that that wasn't true. As the risk increased, the premiums actually flattened out and sometimes declined. And so what you basically have here is an unexplained discount that is being given to the highest risk white neighborhoods.
That was Julia Angwin. She's a senior reporter at ProPublica. She's one of the co-authors of a study spotlighting disparities in automobile insurance premiums between residents of white neighborhoods and predominantly non-white neighborhoods. And she was kind enough to join us from our bureau in New York. Julia, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Billie Holiday, I sing your blues. Bet your life against me and I swear to God you'll lose it. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis.
It has generally been acknowledged that the history and contributions of African Americans has been largely absent from our history books. That's been changing, but to a very large degree, that history has been left to African Americans themselves to research and report. One who was prolific at doing just that was St. Louis and Patricia McKissick. She and her husband collaborated on some 100 books for young readers, most of which focused on the African-American historical experience. Patricia McKissick died a week ago in St. Louis County at the age of 72. We are remembering her today with Jennifer Ilardi, youth librarian with the Florissant Valley branch of the St. Louis County Library. And yours too, Jennifer. So nice to have you with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Boy, you've come armed with some of her books. I'm glad you didn't bring them all because I wouldn't be able to see you.
It would have been a lot. Yeah. Absolutely.
She was really something, wasn't it, in terms of being prolific and also the mission that she felt she had.
Absolutely. Like, if you go to our shelves, especially in our biography section and all over, I mean, as I was preparing to come in today and I was looking through just her catalog of the number of books that she wrote, there were so many books that I had read that I didn't even recognize that they were written by her. And it's just so amazing just how many that her and her husband have made available. And thinking of a library without them in there, you can tell that there would be a huge hole in what would be available for children to learn about African American history.
Sure, and the full range. It's not just history. It's some are a little bit scary. And so
yes. Oh my goodness. I gravitate towards picture books because I like the way that the images and the words work together. And when I do storytelling in classrooms and in schools, so I always gravitate towards those. And so like Precious and the Boo Hag was a really fun one, and it's kind of creepy, kind of scary, but still gentle enough to be able to share with the youngest students. students and not freak them out entirely.
Did you ever have a chance to meet her?
I didn't. Unfortunately, I did not. And I know that there was going to be an opportunity, but it was around the same time that her husband passed away. And so I did not get a chance to. But I did speak with several librarians who had met her and who said that she was just so down to earth and wonderful. And then even reading the author notes, which I know sometimes we just go ahead and skip that page and start our story. Mm-hmm. But when you read the author notes that she provides in her books, she just feels, you know, like a family member almost. You know, like I can recognize some of the language that she uses, some of the stories that she tells are similar, not exactly the same, but then looking at interviews of her online and whatnot, like just a wonderful, wonderful woman. And I've heard only good things about how down to earth she was.
Well, one of the things that I've read about her is that the loss of her husband, with whom she worked so closely, I guess it was in 2013, really devastated her. I mean, it changed things.
Yeah, I can't imagine. I mean, and when I watched them on an interview, it was amazing to see how, you know, they were working together and how you could tell that they really loved each other. And that's just heartbreaking to think about.
What was the actual age range of the books? How young did she write for?
I think she writes for, you know, maybe as early as 5, I would say. And then she's got teen books. She's got adult books about history and everything. So she really did write all across the board, and even had like easy readers for preschool children to be able to learn how to read. Messy Bessie is a early reader to be able to, you know, learn those sight words and that sort of stuff. And then, of course, storytelling transcends age. So for an adult to be able to share some of these stories like Flossie and the Fox with some of the, with your young people, I mean, it's all about just sharing stories. And she really provided great tools to be able to do that for parents and for children alike.
She, at some point in her younger life, discovered that there was a big gap and the kind of information that was out there for young African-Americans.
Yeah, and she mentioned that, like, Virginia Hamilton was a mentor of hers, and she wrote The People Could Fly. Right? Yeah. And then Walter Dean Myers is a really awesome author, too. And then she noticed that, you know, that between, like, I think she said 1800s up through, like, the Harlem Renaissance era was a part where she just thought she could share some information and to do some research about, and how she writes historical fiction, because she uses the information that she can get, and then she fills in the holes with her imagination. She fills in the gaps in order to make some really entertaining books for students of all ages.
And I guess her husband, Frederick, did most of the research for it. Well, not most. I wouldn't say that, but a lot of it. That was his role.
From what I understand, yeah. And then he also was able to, from the interview that some of the interviews that I watched, she mentioned how he helped with some of the endings of her stories, like with Flossie and the Fox, of saying, like, you know, how does that, you know, like something wasn't right. And he couldn't tell her exactly what it needed, but he was able to kind of help her think about it a little bit more. So I think they collaborated. It seems as though they collaborated on multiple different levels when it came to the books.
Her primary influence and inspiration was Paul Laurence Dunbar. Is that right?
I did hear that, yeah.
Yeah. She saw that and was some of the things that he had written and wondered, you know, why isn't there more of this sort of thing out there?
Yeah, and we even see it now, too. You know, we have some amazing authors that are able to share the African-American experience, but we could use more to be able to help share our history with children.
Some of that is starting to happen now, but it's pretty late in the game. I mean, you're right. There's a lot more is necessary, particularly today, and today's a need for understanding.
Yeah,
and the
absolutely.
Conversations we have to have. We have some folks who want to get into this conversation. We'll talk more, obviously, but let's bring in some people who want to talk. So, Donna in St. Louis, it's your turn. Go ahead. Donna, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Good afternoon.
Hi, go ahead.
Well, I met Mr. and Mrs. McKissick through my aunt and uncle, Eldora and Anderson Betts, who lived here in St. Louis, Missouri. And Mr. Betts had been very good friends with the McKissicks. And she was a little younger than him, her and her husband. But also Mr. Betts is one of the gentlemen that she interviewed for her story about the Pullman porters. And it was that many of her books have very rich and beautiful history of the local communities, and I never got over, after reading about the Pullman porters, how during the Great Depression, when people were starving and had no money or food, that in every major city, many of the ministers would go to the railroad tracks, and the Pullman porters would provide them with food, baskets of food from the trains, and sometimes that would be the only food that some of their parishioners would get or have. And also, the story about Brother Wynn was the story about how her grandmother and father met as children. And it was just, you know, every time a new book of hers would come out, it would be richer, and the language was always very beautiful. And, you know, it was just wonderful. And when I heard you talking about her earlier in the week, I thought, okay, she another honor or a new book. And I was very saddened to hear that she passed.
We all were.
Yes, she'll be missed. She will be missed. And I remember even some of the first books that she wrote were about her twin boys. And she was just a really lovely lady, a wonderful lady. And she was definitely a great deal has been lost with her death.
Donna, thank you so much for the call and for your recollection of Patricia McKissick. You read her as a child?
Yeah.
How did it change you?
Oh, I am a librarian. I tell stories, and I love going into schools and telling stories and being in front and to be able to share words with students. So if it wasn't for her books or finding books really? Like hers, it would not have been the same. And I grew up in a very small town. I'm biracial. And finding other books that represented my father's side of the family was tricky. So her books, absolutely. We had a tiny different little library. So, I mean, books are windows, mirrors, and doors. Like, we need to be able to see ourselves in books. We need to be able to see others and their lifestyles in books and to find opportunities to explore something new in books. And so I don't know what would have happened if I wouldn't have had access to these types of books and to her books when I was a child.
Now to music. Many people were shocked and upset by the death of singer-songwriter Prince last April.
Dig, if you will, the picture of you and I engaged in a kiss.
New Yorker contributing writer Ben Greenman decided to turn his grief into an exploration of Prince's work. Greenman's new book is called Dig, If You Will, The Picture. Leah Donella of NPR's Code Switch team tells us more about it.
Ben Greenman has been a Prince fan since 1982, when he was in middle school. But even a dedicated Prince follower like Greenman has trouble categorizing Prince's music.
From very early on, he just shattered ideologies.
Greenman is a culture writer for The New Yorker and the author of several books about musicians, both fiction and nonfiction. He says Prince loved to play around with constructions of race. When he first signed a contract with Warner Brothers in the late 70s, Prince didn't want to be categorized as a black musician. Remember, this was before MTV, and before so-called black music was heavily marketed to white audiences. So Prince stirred up rumors about his racial identity, claiming to be multiracial even though both of his parents were black. In his 1984 movie Purple Rain, Prince's dad is played by a black man, and his mother is played by a white Greek woman.
You don't care about me.
Don't I keep the heat on?
I don't like it here. You never talk to me.
Dad, please.
In Greenman's new book, he also talks about the ways Prince toyed with gender and sexuality. Take the 1981 song, Controversy.
There's a line early on when he says, am I black or white? Am I straight or gay? A famous lyric. And some of it was to create mystique, but as he went on, some of it became a legitimate inquiry.
Prince had a sort of alter ego he called his Camille persona, which he used in songs like If I Was Your Girlfriend, where he was trying to convey things from a more female perspective.
Your girlfriend. Would you let me wash your hair? Could I make
make your breakfast sometime?
And according to Greenman, there was a strategy behind Prince's race and gender bending.
That process was to isolate two theoretically opposed aspects of a self, of a person, male, female, black, white, straight, gay, good, evil. And he played out that opposition in his work. Sometimes he resolved it to his satisfaction. Usually he didn't, and the tension between those two things powered the work. That was the engine at the center.
Behind the scenes, Prince was notoriously shy, and he didn't do a lot of interviews. But when he did, he committed hard to the idea that he and his music were not to be put into a box. In a 1999 TV appearance, Larry King expressed confusion at what to call Prince, who at the time was not going by Prince, but an unpronounceable symbol.
How would you describe your music? What idiom would you put it in?
The only thing I could think of, because I really don't like categories, but the only thing I could think of is inspirational. And I think music that is from the heart falls right into that category.
The way Prince forced fans to reckon with their own notions of identity was a form of activism, Greenman says, an activism that evolved over the course of Prince's musical career.
A lot of the way he addressed social issues was revolutionary early on and sort of slogan-based. He would urge people to educate themselves or overthrow the existing order or don't listen to everyone. And they were, it's not that they were bromides necessarily. On an album like Controversy, he talked about Reagan and he talked about nuclear proliferation and he talked about the Atlanta child murders. He was very into the news and the news cycle, and I think always was. There's a song very late in his career called Baltimore about, you know, the Freddie Gray case and the unrest in Baltimore.
Does anybody hear us pray for Michael Brown or Freddie Gray? Peace is more than the absence of war.
Those kinds of songs get processed differently than the songs that are part of the core Prince identity of the 80s. I think those in some ways are easier to go back to. They have a different kind of energy. It's like staring into the sun.
For Ben Greenman, writing Dig If You Will the Picture was a way to start processing that overwhelming brightness that defined Prince's career. Leah Donnella, NPR News.
The world suffered two big losses yesterday. Both who passed were significant in very different but important ways. Judge Sheila Abdus Salam, the first black woman to serve on New York State's highest court, was found in the Hudson River after it appeared she had been out jogging. Circumstances regarding her passing aren't yet known, but she was raised in D.C. and graduated from Columbia Law School in 1977. Governor Andrew Cuomo described her as a trailblazing jurist and a force for good. Then there's Charlie Murphy. Eddie Murphy's older brother, he had a large catalog of Hollywood work, including his classic True Hollywood Stories on Comedy Central's Chappelle Show. He went from sidekick to main star and was a fan favorite as a result. He lost the battle to leukemia at 57. Both will be missed, and it's another reminder that we should give people the credit they deserve while they're actually still here to see it. I'm Clinton Yates, and that's my take.
Today there's been a breaking story, and I thought that I would discuss this particular story and the various issues that I picked up on this particular story. I'm sure you heard of the name Sheila Abdus Salam. If you never hear of this name, then I would suggest that you search it on social media, Google it. Who was she? Sheila Abdus Salam was a judge on the New York Court of Appeals. She was the first African-American Muslim judge to be appointed to a seat on New York's highest court. And she was also the first Muslim female to serve on the bench in the United States of America. Now, if you have any knowledge about the legal structure, the legal fraternity, then you would understand that this was a major achievement. She was 65 years old. What happened is, unfortunately, just a few hours ago, her body was found floating in the Hudson River. The circumstances surrounding her death are unknown. But since the story broke, and I've been searching it on social media and on the news sites, there are three issues that I picked up. And I would like to discuss this, inshallah, it can be a lesson for all of us. The first thing I picked up was on Twitter. A few hours ago, just after her body was discovered, the Hudson River was trending on Twitter because this is where her body was found floating. However, her name, Sheila Abdus Salam, was not trending. And this is unfortunate when you think about it. The reason is because we're living in such a time that when there's a tragedy, we forget about the person and we just regard it as a stat. So we look at Hudson River, we look at the fact that she was a lawyer, but the person, a human being, has passed away. We forget about that. And that is why when we generally tweet about it, we forget about the name. In fact, many supporters of Sheila Abdus Salam, they actually started a hashtag, say her name. Hashtag say her name. This is because they wanted her name to trend instead of the Hudson River. It was unfortunate, and of course, it's a very sensitive issue. So even when it comes to other areas, when it comes to other countries, when it comes to other people passing away, we should keep this in mind. It's a sensitive issue. It's not just a news headline. It's not just something we can just tweet about and choose our own words. It's not something we can just post on social media, choose our own words, choose our own details, put up any image, but it's very sensitive. If we want to spread it, we try to use words that are appropriate. I mean, you got to understand, what if somebody from your family passes away? What if a close friend passes away and you hear about this news on social media or hear about it in the news? Of course, you'd want to hear about it in a very soft way. You wouldn't want anyone to take advantage of the story. We need to understand that everybody is a human. It's not just about the stats. You know, one lady was found floating in the Hudson River. But it's about life as well. Same thing can be said for the people in Syria. We always say, you know, we just say it off the tip of our tongues. 50 passed away in explosion. 35 children passed away. 15 females were killed and so on. And just the list goes on. May Allah Ta'ala make it easy for them. But we need to also remember that when we say 15 females, that's 15 humans lost their lives. So we need to have that sensitivity in our words and that sensitivity in our thoughts. But you can check this hashtag out on Twitter, say her name, and you'll find all the details there. Another thing I found here, and this one, to be honest, was not surprising at all. The media, mainstream media in particular, is not mentioning that she was a Muslim. Now remember, who was Sheila Abdus Salam? She was an African-American Muslim female from the United States of America. She was a judge on the New York Court of Appeals. Many mainstream media houses, they did focus on the story, but they failed to mention that she was a Muslim in a headline. So I'll just give you a few examples. If you go on Twitter, you see, look at CNN. When CNN spoke about it, this is how they tweeted. CNN said, Sheila Abdus Salam, first African-American woman appointed to New York Court of Appeals, was found dead in the Hudson River. There's no mention made there that she's a Muslim. The New York Times, their headline was, Sheila Abdus Salam, judge on New York's top court, is found dead in the Hudson River. There's no mention made that she's a Muslim. Washington Post, judge Sheila Abdus Salam, first African-American woman on New York's top court, found dead in Hudson River. Once again, there's no mention made of Muslim. Yes, there's a few of these houses, the media houses. If you go into the article and read it, you'll find their mention is made that she was a Muslim. But in the title itself, there is no mention made of Muslim. The problem I have here is whenever there's an explosion of any sort, whenever there's a terrorist attack on anyone, anywhere in the world, before any investigations, already you will find in the articles, you will find in the headlines, there's the name Muslim is there, the name Islamist is there, the name Sharia is there, the name Islam is there. All these words are found in the headlines. Whenever there's a Muslim that could be a suspect. But here, when a Muslim was a victim, when an innocent Muslim was killed, then all of a sudden the name Muslim is not there. What we learn from here, what lesson we can take from here, we need to understand that majority of the media houses are critics of Islam. Whichever way you want to put it, they are critical of Islam. They will never display the positives. Even when Muhammad Ali passed on about a year ago, they only spoke about his achievements as far as boxing is concerned. And some of them spoke about his fight for the African-American struggle. But very few spoke about Muhammad Ali as a Muslim. Some of them, in fact, mentioned the name Cassius Clay more than they mentioned the name Muhammad Ali. But that's a whole different topic. But coming back to the point here, we learn here not to trust media. Yes, we can take a bit of information here and there wherever we need it. In fact, I do take information from there as well, from the media houses, mainstream media. But we don't ever trust them 100%. They will be critical of Islam. They will never display Islam in a positive manner. It is up to us. It is our duty to display Islam in a positive manner. Another point that I picked out here is some media houses are saying that it was a suicide. Some media houses are saying that it was a suicide, and this is only a few hours after her body was discovered. According to reports coming in, they are saying there were no signs of trauma or injury on the body, and her cause of death is still under investigation. But because there were no signs of injury or trauma or assault, media houses are jumping to the conclusion that it was a suicide. Now, how can this be? It's only a few hours. A thorough investigation did not yet take place. My question is, would they say the same thing if Sheila Abdus-Salam, number one, was not a Muslim, and number two, was not African-American? Whenever there's another fatality, when somebody else passes away that is not African-American, do they jump to the conclusion and say it's suicide? Or they start looking for that person who's behind the act? Do they start looking for the murderer? In most cases, they do. But why now, just a few hours after her body was found floating, all of a sudden they're jumping to the conclusion that it was suicide? Is it because of the color of her skin? Is it because of her religious affiliation? Google the story, Google the name Sheila Abdus-Salam, read about it, and just pay very close attention to what's happening on social media and on the various websites regarding this particular story. Let's recap those three things I picked up. Number one is people were not mentioning a name, and there was more mention made of the Hudson River than her name, Sheila Abdus-Salam. That is why a hashtag started, say her name. The second thing I picked up is that media is not mentioning that she was a Muslim. And the third thing I picked up is people are jumping to the conclusion that it was a suicide. I asked myself the question, if she was not African-American, or if she was not a Muslim, would they still jump to this conclusion? May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala give us tawfiq, inshaAllah. And may Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala grant Sister Sheila Abdus-Salam Jannatul Firdaus. And may Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala grant her family patience during this difficult time.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, April 15th, 2017. So I have been told this is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have commentary you would like to share on any of the audio clips that we just heard, other news that took place over the last 7 days, or if you just have general counter-racist suggestions, observations. The number to dial, 641-715-3640. The code, 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code, 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. Before we get to some of the folks who dialed in, as always, we are listener-supported counter-racist radio. You can visit my blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. When you hit the blog, look in the top right corner. You will see my PayPal button. If you are not into PayPal, drop me an email. We will get you a physical mailing address, the email untiljustice@gmail.com. Huge thanks to all the folks who have supported us 8+ years. I hope the program has been, continues to be worthy of your time and energy. Folks who have invested, folks who've got us things from my wish list, which is at Amazon.com under Gus T. Renegade. Wish list is also linked at Amazon.com. Thanks for all the folks who have nabbed items from the list as well. I want to get a few things in before I get to some of the callers. The first thing, when they played the segment, or the news clip rather, that detailed the higher insurance rates for black people, and that it seemed like, just based on evidence, that in areas, residential areas that had predominantly white residents, even if there was an increase in traffic or in traffic vehicle accidents and what have you, even if that rose, they still didn't increase the insurance rates for white people who lived in those areas. That song, Riding Dirty, and that whole I don't even know what it is now, cliche about black people not having all of their correct information when they ride, not having proof of insurance or not having insurance, not having a valid driver's license or not having your seatbelt buckled, all these other things where they come up with all these reasons and justification why they have to stop Sandra Bland or any number, not Philando Castile, the incident that happened in Minnesota over the summer. But all the different black people that end up getting stopped in a vehicle and shot and killed. I think Daniel Holtzclaw, a number of the victims that he was sexually terrorizing in Oklahoma City, I think he stopped some of these people, some of these black females, when they were in their vehicle. So just something to, at least for me, made me think about that in a whole different context, that whites, their scheme in terms of how they are targeting and terrorizing black people is so in-depth. I don't even think we know the myriad of ways that we are being attacked under the system of racism, white supremacy. And then people will end up thinking that it's us, that it's something about us. So we just can't get, you know, all of our paperwork together and be proper legal motorists. No, we're under a system of racism, white supremacy, and whites are constantly terrorizing us. I also thought it was important, just in that same vein, I've mentioned this before because this has happened multiple times. I'm here in Washington State. I know other non-white people, non-white, non-black people. This is the second time, just within the last couple of days, that a non-white, non-black person got into an accident. That was their fault. Hit another vehicle. Was their fault. They did not have insurance. They did not go to jail. Were not handcuffed on the scene. Things were dealt with and things rolled right along. And both times that I heard it, when I heard it previously, and I think I mentioned it on the program, and then when I heard it just a few days ago, both times, you know, hey, was everybody okay? Were there any injuries? No. As soon as that was taken care of, it moved to, was anybody arrested? Did anybody have to go to jail? No. Okay. Then immediately I went into, that is racism, white supremacy. I have lived in other parts of the world. They don't have a lot of black people here in Seattle, so they don't have the same type of draconian laws where they just lock up motorists for any old type of thing. They don't have that sort of thing here, although they still lock up a lot of black people. We've had Seattle prosecuting attorneys on the program who testified to that, that they think about 40% of the cases that they see are black people. Seattle doesn't even, 10% of the Seattle population is not even black. I think the Seattle population is less than 8% here. But where you can have black people in cities like Atlanta and other areas where you have large numbers of black people where they get locked up just for not having proof of insurance. I remember when I lived in Atlanta, it was tons of black people that I knew, that I was friends with, that I worked with, went to jail, no proof of insurance. And from my understanding, it doesn't even have to be that you didn't have insurance. From my understanding, in some locations, you can have insurance. But if you're in your vehicle and you get stopped by an enforcement official and you don't have proof of insurance, that can be enough to land you in greater confinement. Not just a citation or what have you, but I mean handcuffed, ride to the precinct, the whole nine until you get the situation straightened out. So to hear that repeatedly just for me was another reminder of why I am a curmudgeon, why I'm not a nice person, why I make an effort to emphasize that we do have a racial hierarchy, and that the darker you are, particularly if you get labeled black in the system of white supremacy, you're going to be treated worse. That doesn't mean that I sit around and name call non-white, non-black people, but I do point out these are the mechanics. This is what racism, white supremacy is and how it works. Racists do not subject non-black, non-white people to the same levels of terrorism that they subject black people to, and that is worldwide. Next point. This week, I was finally able to go to the Jacob Lawrence exhibit at the Seattle Art Museum. I had been talking about this for a while, that I was really excited to go. I'm still a little disappointed. The extra lovely Isabel Wilkerson was here. She wrote The Warmth of Other Suns, which we did in the book club, one of my top five books all time. But she was here because she talks about Jacob Lawrence. That's her whole book is about the migration series and Jacob Lawrence, his famous migration series. It's 60 panels, portraits detailing the black people who left the terrorism of the South, Mississippi, Florida, Alabama, Louisiana, left those areas and traveled anywhere they could to try to minimize the amount of terrorism that they were being subjected to. And I went to the exhibit on Wednesday. I was able to take a lot of pictures. It was a great experience. I'm not someone, I was thinking about it. I have gone to museums before. Obviously, I haven't had the pleasure of visiting the new African-American Museum of History in Washington, D.C., but I have been to the Smithsonian. I've been to the King Center down in Atlanta. I've been to the Seattle Art Museum before. I have been to a number of museums before, but I think this might have been the first time that I went to an actual art exhibit. I am not that cultured where I've had the fortune of being able to go out and check out art or even the interest in going to check out art. That's an art exhibit anywhere, even black artists. So I was really excited. It was $25. I think I said on the program before, but my view, that is a prohibitive cost, I think, for a number of black people. I can speak for myself. I know for Gus T, when I first moved here, if it had been $25, I'm not sure if I would have been able to go immediately. That would have maybe been something where I would have had to plan to see if I could have scraped my nickels together when I first moved here. And in fact, when I went to the King Center the first time in Atlanta, they had the Without Sanctuary exhibit, which is just a massive collage of white terrorism. It's all these images of black lynchings. Some of them, it's the lynching postcards. They have artwork that's some of the anti-lynching work that was done, letters, work like Ida B. Wells, Barnett, infamous black journalist, work to stop lynchings. But they have all this stuff on display. It was at the King Center in Atlanta. It was free when I went. This was like within the first week or so when I moved to Atlanta. If it had been $25, again, I'm not sure if I would have been able to go immediately. Now, I'm sure I could have scraped together a few nickels. I got a job pretty quickly once I went there. But 25 is kind of steep, and I suspect that sort of thing keeps black people from being able to appreciate those type of exhibits. But I bought my ticket in advance. Shout out to Kendra. She even sent me $25 to make sure that I could go. Bought my ticket in advance online, which I did purposely as a counter-racist act because I did not want to have to go through the ticket line. I wanted to try to minimize as much direct contact with whites as I could. So I bought my ticket, just moved through everything. You could just plow right through, go right into the exhibit for the museum. I get there. The exhibit is on the third floor. The Seattle Art Museum is pretty large. It's about a 4 or 5 floor building. Whites, you know, big time invest in artwork out here. So I get to the exhibit, there's a massive line outside, which I was not prepared for as much. It's like middle of the day, maybe a little bit after noon. Big line outside. So I'm waiting. I have my camera and, you know, whatever. As I get in line, there is a group of white people behind me, including the white woman in cornrows that I posted on my Facebook page. She and the group that she's with, they're talking about the movie Hidden Figures, and this is so important, and I didn't even know about these black women and all the work that they did at NASA and get the space launch, and it was such a gripping movie, and my God, they don't even have things like this in the school system, and I thought it was real, and she is just on and on and on. I don't know if they struck this conversation up when they came in the line, like, oh, a Nick was at the exhibit. I don't know if that happened. I don't know if they were having, you know, a serious dialogue about this before they even saw that I was in line. But this conversation went on and on and on. And then they hopped from Hidden Figures to the Jacob Lawrence exhibit. These white people were not ignorant about racism. They were very informed about Jacob Lawrence, his exhibit, the Black Migrate. I mean, you could just run it all the way down. That is poppycock. The people that think these white folks are, you know, just dumb and need a remedial course on what their ancestors have done to us. There's a black guy in front of me in the line. I did not speak to him. I am curmudgeon, a little bit antisocial. I was much more intrigued by the racists behind me, particularly since this white woman has got cornrows and is doing all this flagrant talk about racism. But we finally get in to the exhibit. The room is relatively, it's smaller than what I expected. These panels are relatively small. I would say they are a little bit larger than maybe, I don't know if I had to ballpark it. They're maybe a little bit larger than 8 by 15 or something to that nature, maybe 10 by 15. They're not massive portraits. So the room is about 400 square feet to give you, you know, some scale. If I had to give a range, I'd say that's probably within 50 square feet or so. So it's a much more intimate setting than what I was expecting. So you're really kind of tightly in with all the other people as you're going around to look at these 60 panels. And I'm looking at all the art. I'm looking at the exhibits. I'm looking at other people there. There are only two black people that I saw while I'm at the exhibit. So that would be a total of three, including myself. I didn't expect there to be any black people. This is Seattle, but lots of white people checking out the artwork. And Jacob Lawrence, black male, the art that he looks at, it details black people, the conditions that they experienced in the South, sharecropping and being cheated, lynchings, police terrorism, just everything that you can think of that we talked about, Warmth of Other Suns, and details white people not allowing black people to get on the trains and putting them in jail and making them miss their train to try to get, you know, away. It's just remarkable. I really appreciated Jacob Lawrence. He has a specific picture that shows black people reading black newspapers. He talked about the monumental importance of black journalism in giving black people hope, letting them know about other environments that they could potentially migrate to that might be better for them, what happened to relatives that moved on, really reminded me about the importance, long and historical importance of black journalism. But the family that was behind me, we pretty much stayed in the same line all the way as we went through the exhibit and looked at all the portraits. So we finally get around. We're about three quarters of the way through looking at the paintings. And finally I say, you know, hey, I'm going to ask her to get a photograph. Kyle's listeners might not believe me if I tell them, yeah, it was a white woman there in cornrows. So I go to ask her. I don't have to make up a story. I don't have to give her any credentials. Like, yeah, I'm, you know, such and such with Seattle Times. And, you know, I'm the only Negro. I didn't, none of that. Just, oh, hey, ma'am, can I get a picture of you with one of the paintings? Oh, sure. She was ready to roll, snatched her. I think that's her grandson. She snatched him in it. I put the photo on my Facebook page. I tweeted as well. You can check it out. I think my tweet was that Seattle has so few black people, they made white chicks at the Jacob Lawrence exhibit wear cornrows. That was my tweet of it all. But that, again, just shows, in my view, the colossal refinement of Seattle racism. This white woman, in addition to cornrows, she had on an African print purse that you can see in the picture that I took that's on the Facebook page. It was stunning. I took a lot of pictures of the exhibit, but I mean, you could just look online for the Jacob Lawrence migration and series, and you'll be able to see the portraits that are in the, all the panels that are in the series. I took a lot of pictures. It was great. Glad I got to go. And I would just encourage, if we have any listeners out there who have any sort of skills that you've cultivated, if you're an artist, if you're a musician, use whatever talent you have to speak and convey information about white supremacy. That is one of the best things that I think we can do to help towards the production of justice, to really make sure we use all of our skills, because that's what racist man, racist woman, racist child, that's what they do. They use all of their skill and intellect to stomp on niggers. We have to do the exact opposite. Use all of our skill to produce justice, completely and permanently eradicate racism, white supremacy. I'm gonna, reminded me of all of the Bill Cosby put a lot of effort into promoting black art as well, both in the Cosby Show and even since all of this has come up with the charges and accusations. I think he has a lot of his black artwork at the Smithsonian, and I think one of our listeners who saw it there said they had some sort of tacky note up, like, oh yeah, we don't endorse that raping nigra Bill Cosby, but he does have a lot of black artwork, and we're going to display what these niggers drew here for a few days or weeks. I don't know if the stuff is still there, but I know it was there rather recently at the Smithsonian. With that, we will get to the callers. If the Jacob Lawrence exhibit comes to your area, check it out. The number again, 641-715-3640. No metaphors, please. Consistently racist, they will use metaphors, comparisons to equate things that are not similar. They do this, in my view, as a deliberate means of practicing white supremacy and lying. Non-white people, we have been greatly impacted, contaminated by a lot of their behaviors, and we are still learning. Sometimes, as we continue to try to figure out and articulate our thoughts and views on white supremacy, we will employ a metaphor to explain, articulate our thoughts. Often, these metaphors do not minimize confusion. They do not even clearly articulate what it is that we want to say. So if we can make an effort, no metaphors, be direct, explicit about what it is that you would like to say. No background noise, if no speakerphone, if you know you're in a noisy environment, television is on, you're watching the playoffs or cooking out or getting ready for Easter egg hunt, use your mute button. That way you can speak when you have something to say, then you can mute your line so we don't pick up all that background distortion. Much obliged. First few folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Hey, how you doing, Beth?
Right, Portland. Hello?
Hey, all right. I wanted to talk about just two things. Some from the segment. I have experienced that. I'm in the East Coast area. I grew up in Newark, New Jersey, and Newark insurance rates are very high. So I had to use my grandparents, my grandmother's address at times where she lives in a white area, and it's hundreds of dollars less than if you was to use a Newark address with a fairly good driving record. I mean, to give you an estimation, right now I pay about $106. If I was to use the Newark address, that's $106 a month. If I use the Newark address, I can pay up to $200 to $300 a month. So it's just a big difference. Over the week, I was listening to an old broadcast of yours. You were talking about the Boondocks. And I really enjoyed that show. I thought it was real funny. I thought that it did tackle racism, white supremacy. But listening to the old broadcast, you persuaded me. I've noticed things that I really never paid attention to. When you brought up that there's no positive black women, I really never paid attention to that. Never. I mean, it was probably one or two, if best. But the question at hand was whether the Boondocks was positive. How did you feel after looking at the Boondocks? Did you feel better being an African American? Did you feel worse? And just last year, there was a white gentleman that verbally assaulted a black gentleman in a road rage altercation, and he began to lecture this black gentleman on what's wrong with the black community. And he referenced the Boondocks. And so when I heard your broadcast and you asked the question whether the Boondocks made white people feel uncomfortable or did it boost black self-esteem, that particular incident, and that incident went viral. I really couldn't tell you where to Google to find this incident. But the gentleman recorded, this white gentleman verbally attacking him, also physically threatening him. And he used the Boondocks, and he used the episode where Martin Luther King came back from a coma. And when at the end, Martin Luther King chastised black people on what we were doing wrong and what we needed to do. And this white, not even suspected racist, used that as a reference point to chastise this black drama. I just found that interesting, and I just wanted to bring that up, and that's all.
Fascinating. The Boondocks. I was thinking about that show this past week. I think it would depend on which season, which episode you watch in terms of how you end up feeling about the constructive value of the content. Other folks who are with us that we have not heard from, if you have commentary, proceed.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for taking my call. Just a few comments, and I'm actually a caller from Ohio. I have called in on the workplace racism show, and I had to be pretty brief about just the issues that I was going through and my friend. And I briefly spoken up. I spoke about how my friend was being terrorized by our supervisor, and she had, it was just a non-white black female, and how, like, whenever she would try to move to, like, at least work at home or try to do something else within the department, he would find a reason why she couldn't do that, consistently ask her questions, bother her at work while she's trying to do her work. And she had told me recently that, you know, she always had, she started to say negative things about him. And so actually today we just recently found out that he died. And we're both, because I've felt the same way about him kind of terrorizing us, and we don't really know how to feel. She's definitely very, I don't really want to say upset. Like she says she didn't know if she should cry or, you know, she doesn't really feel like she should cry, but she was definitely, I don't know, surprised. I don't want to use a metaphor or anything like that. So that's one of the things. So I also don't know how to feel as well. I wouldn't say I was sad or anything. The other thing that I wanted to speak about was Judge Sheila Abdudas Salam. I'm sorry if I'm not pronouncing that right. I also noticed the fact how they immediately said, well, they don't find, I was watching some news channel and or some news clip, what have you, and how they didn't see any foul play. But I don't understand how if someone is found in a river and if they didn't have any known medical issues, anything that would want them to, I guess even like the clip said, commit suicide, how would there not be foul play if you're found in a river? I'm sure as a judge she would have, you know, the means of, and I'm to have the means to do something else with another gym, just, you know, go around a river. I guess was just what happened with that news clip. It definitely really helps refocus my attention on the fact that, you know, we are in this racist system, because I do feel that I do kind of, I don't know, I guess I don't want to say I forget, but it's, I don't know how to quite describe it. So I guess I'm just going to take my call offline. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for calling in, caller in Ohio. I just wanted to get out a reminder as well for the folks that were listening or the people that are listening online. The stream had some disruption in it earlier. This is like a while ago, significantly. If you know, it should be taken care of. If you had a problem, you can just refresh and it'll be straight. I think it was isolated just to the live stream. Other folks that we have not heard from, if you have a hand up, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings to you, Gus, and to the other callers and listeners. Very interesting clips. First, I just wanted to talk about an incident after work I experienced yesterday. It was actually Thursday, and I didn't get the opportunity to call in for workplace racism, but it was actually traveling home from work, and this made me think of The Invisible Man. My son actually just bought that book for me, and he's finding it to be very powerful. And anyway, I was riding the train coming home from work, and I was getting off the train to catch another train, and as I was getting off, there was this short, round white lady who just refused to wait for everyone to leave the train before attempting to board the train. And I happened to be the person that she tried to plow her way through to get on the train. So I literally had to shove her out the way. I called her out of her name and said, "What the F are you doing? You know, you wild savage." I said, "You need to wait and let people get off the train." And it was just so agitating because that's something I've experienced before with white females and, well, not really white males per se. They usually get out of my way. But I've experienced that quite a bit with white females where they either act like they don't see you or they see you and still act like they don't see you. So I make sure that they know that I'm there because, you know, you can't just walk through another person. Two things can't occupy the same space at the same time. And I'm pretty rude about it whenever those things happen, but that was just agitating. Anyway, to get to the clips, the story on the judge, Sheila Abduz Salam, was just very interesting because they did speak very early in the news about it not being foul play. And in one article I read, they alluded to law enforcement saying that. And I'm like, well, if she was just found dead, law enforcement didn't have enough time, like the guy said in the clip, to have done a thorough investigation for the news to be reporting this the way they did. And whenever they do report something like that, where there's this sort of premature rush to judgment that there wasn't foul play, that makes me think immediately that there was foul play and that some powerful people are trying to manipulate the perception of the public to think that the situation is different than what it actually is. And also there was another black male judge that was killed in Chicago, Cook County, if I'm not mistaken, in the article. And the title of the article was, "Is There Ethnic Cleansing Going On in the U.S. Court System, the U.S. Justice System?" And you just never know. You never know. And they were kind of made connections between these two deaths in a way that I found to be very interesting. And I wouldn't put anything past white people because they're just that dangerous. And one thing I found interesting about the clip was when the guy was speaking about the fact that the media was not discussing that she was Muslim. And I started to go over these things in my head, and I thought to myself, he's absolutely right. They only discuss the Muslim factor when there's something negative going on. And then I thought about it, well, when Christians get killed, no one plays up the fact that they're Christian. I've never heard them say, well, a Christian person killed in whatever incident took place. They only play up Muslims, and it's always negative, and they only play up Jews, and it's always negative in the form of anti-Semitism. So it just seems like the bias in media is biased in favor of white Jewish people and bias that's negative in regards to Muslims, whether they're black or non-white, non-black. So I found that to be just an interesting observation. And then when you spoke about Bill Cosby, it made me think because last week they discussed the fact that Little Bill, which is like his critically acclaimed cartoon series and book series that was like one of the top 10 book series in regards to children's books, was actually placed on the top 10 most banned list this past week. And it was due to the allegations, all the sexual allegations that have been going around about Bill Cosby. So I just found that to be just very telling that he's done so much work to try and do things that were positive for the black community and give some form of positive images for us to partake of, regardless of whatever negative things he might have done or said. He's still a victim of white supremacy. And it's just when white people try to destroy you, they try to destroy you as holistically as possible. And that's something to be aware of, especially for people who are in a public space or deal with the public in any way. Because once white people turn on you, they can literally like just destroy your life in ways that are unfathomable. Thank you. And I'll meet my line. Guys.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
This is Jerry calling out Chattanooga. One of the main things that I wanted to speak of is the mayor. I'm not sure if it was the mayor or not. The representative from New Jersey with the commercial that he had as far as like the heroin addiction. I'm calling. My name is Jerry, and I'm calling from Chattanooga, Tennessee. And I've been seeing a lot of people on Facebook speak about sundown towns. And what I know is that around here, all of those are still, they're prevalent. They're very, very prevalent. they still have signs. And this conversation goes on if you're not paying attention. But being a black person, if you are paying attention, you know, it kind of shuns down. And what I'm getting to is like the heroin and the meth addiction is very, very prevalent in their areas. But like what was said with the representative from New Jersey is that we want to treat these people as addicts and not as criminals. Me growing up during the 80s, I was born in 81. I'm 35 years old right now. Everybody that I know, young or old, was sent to prison, whether they was using drugs or not. And now we have this kick going on about how we're going to treat these people as victims. That was probably the most important clip that I heard tonight that you played. Everything else was important, but this is something that's affected me personally because I've been active in that particular situation as far as I've sold drugs before. I've been locked up for drugs, being in the criminal system, all of these things. And it makes me wonder, not necessarily what they're going to do, because we already have a blueprint for what they're going to do, but how are we going to react now that we know this? Are we going to continue to do the same things that we've been doing? Are we going to find some type of other means of getting money? Or are we going to lay down because they're treating these people and they're locking up us for the same actual actions? And I don't know. Maybe that's a question. Maybe it's a statement. I'm not really sure. But for all of the other callers who are listening, that's a question that I want to pose to you, is that how are we going to handle this particular situation when the heroin addicts, they get treatment, the crack addicts, we normally get jail time. And the reason I ask that question is because with the clip with the mandatory minimums and Jeff Sessions coming up with all of these new laws and how he going to govern the United States, although we are only 13 to 14% of the population, we're still being the most incarcerated overall, whether we're doing anything or not, because there's a record of people getting out of jail for things. Well, when I say people, I mean us as a people. We're getting out of jail all the time, 10, 20, 30 years after they found out that we haven't done anything wrong, whether we sold drugs or not, based off of that sole fact that we was in an area where they were selling crack. So it's not a confusion for me. It doesn't confuse me. I'm just wondering, what are we going to do as a people to kind of counteract this particular situation? So with that said, I'll mute my line. I have a whole lot more to say, but I'm going to let the rest of the callers get a chance to ask their questions and hopefully give some input on the question that I just asked. Thank you, Gus.
Yes, sir. Other folks that we have not heard from at all, if you have commentary, your line should be open. Proceed.
Hello. Hello, good evening.
Yes, ma'am.
Is my volume okay? Can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. I wanted to share a story that I heard recently. My name is Rochelle. I'm a second-time caller, but I've benefited from listening to the program for several months now. And I wanted to share a story about a former Marine, Hisashi Pompei. He was in the news recently with his wife out of New Jersey. a state that has had some other issues that were referenced in the clips.
Oh, I'm sorry, ma'am. Second time caller, Rochelle. You reminded me with New Jersey. That was not the mayor. That was Governor Chris Christie that the previous caller was mentioning, who did the public service announcement about how the white heroin addicts were going to be taken care of and not roughed up in the criminal system, much higher up than the mayor. This is governor, someone who was a potential candidate for president. I am so sorry, Rochelle. Please proceed.
Okay, so I was referring a Marine out of New Jersey, the story out of New Jersey, who he was recently, he had his, he was charged and was going to do time in prison for having a firearm, unlawful use of a firearm, which he never used at all. And this was a story I've become more interested in Second Amendment rights of late. And so I've joined several social media groups that have that focus as well, with a focus on safety and responsibility. And this is one of the stories that came up, just how there's a Marine, someone who was well-respected in his field, who had earned a good reputation, but he lost his job as a result of being charged with unlawful use of a firearm. And in the story, it's reported that he did not use the firearm at all. What happened was his firearm was out, accessible, and someone he was with, an associate, was in an altercation and was aware of his weapon and used his weapon, and as a result, someone else was either injured or killed. I don't remember what it said in the article, but because the weapon was lawfully registered in another state, it was lawfully registered in Virginia, but New Jersey doesn't recognize reciprocity, the Marine, the former Marine, Hisashi Pompei, was charged criminally and was set to serve a mandatory minimum of 3 years. And they went on like a campaign, they went on a media outlet. I believe in the article it referenced something like WUSA9 and something called Offscript to kind of garner sympathy, to have people call in and try to convince the sentence to be dropped. And he was set to go to jail on Monday, but he avoided it. The governor did commute the sentence. And so I had to look up that term, commute. What does that mean? Does that mean this guy is now cleared of all charges and he doesn't have to worry about it, given that he did not discharge the weapon? And what I learned is that the term commute actually means that he will not serve time. However, he still will be registered as, an offense, as someone who has this record. So the point I wanted to make was that even when we think there's a show of justice for Black people, there's no real justice, because here's a man who had earned a very high reputation in his field, enough to support his family. He lost his job. There's no word of if that's going to be restored. He was medically discharged, from the military, and he has to have this record. So now if he tries to obtain employment, this is hanging over his head. So I just wanted to, make the point that it just feels like, for our people, especially our men, it's just there's always something to make it more difficult to obtain success. And one of the callers earlier just said, what are we going to do when it's more difficult for us to earn a living or take, and it's almost as if the only route is to find ways to be gained, to have your own source of income that is not dependent on this system, because the system is determined in every way, as we all know, to keep us subjugated. So I just wanted to bring that point up. I don't know if anyone else was aware of that story and had any other information about that. That was all.
Appreciate that. That would be aforementioned Governor Christie, who I assume commuted the sentence in that case. Question I would throw out, if anyone is listening, because then we do not have to do Thursday's workplace racism. I can relax and watch Scandal like everybody else. If any of you all are aware of any employment opportunities that are not directly or indirectly dependent on Racist Man, Racist Woman, Racist Child, then let Gus T. Renegade know. And in fact, I can retire from writing and doing the radio program, and we'll all just go work there. If you all know of any spots in the world where you can get a job and it is not directly, indirectly dependent on Racist Man, Racist Woman, Racist Child. Other folks we have not heard from have commentary. Feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, greetings, Gus, callers, listeners. This is Jay from New York. Constructive clips tonight, Gus. Thanks for sharing. One thing that I wanted to touch on, I have been following the story of Judge Sheila Abdul Salam this week, being out of the New York area here. One thing that, and I'm not sure if I missed it in the clip, but one thing that I have been pulling from different areas in terms of information, and I'll kind of read a quick little paragraph here from one of the articles. It says, although it has been widely reported that she was a Muslim, a spokesperson for the New York Court of Appeals told the New York Times that she was not. According to NBC News, Abdus Salam took her first husband's last name and continued to use it professionally after the divorce. Judge Abdus Salam was married three times, most recently to Gregory Jacobs, just 8 months ago. It was Jacobs who reported her missing to law enforcement. And also, there was a second piece of information that I found, which we're not hearing about. It also said one of the officials also said that both the judge's mother and brother had died in recent years. And I think her mother was 2015 and her brother was 2012, around Easter, the brother by suicide. So just interesting things that I think would definitely, you know, should have been mentioned, especially as they plastered this article like all over the place. And as we heard in the clip, that Muslim theme kind of pushed out there. Just found that to be interesting, and I wanted to share that. The Prince biracial thing, I was totally thrown when I heard that in the clip. I guess I fell for the movie. Because I totally believed in that, and I kind of just went and did some quick research and did see photos of his parents. Pretty interesting. And media is truly a weapon. Had a couple of more things, but I'll let some other folks go and probably chime in a little later on. Thank you.
Let's see, other folks that we... Yes, ma'am. Hi, Karma. If you can speak up, lots of black self-respect, please.
Okay. This is Karma. And, all right. The first thing I wanted to say about the drug article is, did anyone online see the YouTube clip where the white guy was shooting up on the public bus in the middle of the day and overdosed? That was so fascinating. I just showed it to everyone because no one has ever seen anything like that before. Their drug use is, it's just off the chart. It's just out of control. Also with Geico, I had Geico and I moved from, when I was there with Geico, I was talking to other people about their insurance rates, and I met several white people in New York City who didn't have insurance, and I didn't even know that that was an option. If you're a rich white person, you can just carry your own insurance. You put money in the bank, and you say, that's my insurance. Doesn't matter how many times I go out and get drunk, I can still drive. I'm carrying my own insurance. And then when I moved back to Texas, I discovered that Geico had still been charging me New York rates. And when I asked for my money back, they said no, and I had to get law enforcement officials to force Geico to give me my money back. They just blatantly wanted to steal my money. I also want to mention that in keeping with Mr. Sessions and getting ready for more jails, in Texas, they're very excited with Child Protective Services because what they're doing is they're really excited. They're in there talking about it's the number one thing on the budget. We've got to finally give tons and tons of money to Child Protective Services because they are so geared up about sending all of these Mexican people back to Mexico and keeping their children. So instead of forcing the children to go to, you know, reservation schools off the reservation, they can send their parents home. They can raise Latino children the way they want to. They can indoctrinate them into the system because for the most part, they have their own culture and they keep their own culture. But this is a way of really finally getting rid of that Latino culture in Texas. All of the white people are gung-ho about putting as much money into foster care as possible. And all of the Latino people know it because they're going into pouring into lawyers' offices and giving people power of attorney because they know they're just going to be snatched up and sent back to Mexico for, you know, no real reason. And the last thing is I saw a black person sort of attain a greater level of consciousness.
Whoops. Wait a minute. Sorry about that. Not hearing Karma. Okay, we have you back. You said greater level of consciousness. Continue.
Yes. So he in the school board meeting, they were showing all the data and statistics about all the black children, you know, that they were way behind all the white children. There was a huge gap, but he said, but we're closing the gap. And the black guy who was on the school board finally said, and I've been watching this guy for 3 years, he said, I've been on the school board for 15 years. Every year you've been closing the gap. That doesn't make any sense at all. And I know that doesn't sound like much, but for here, that is a great deal. So, I mean, I think finally the school is on a path to opening its eyes a little bit.
That opening its eyes, that is a metaphor, but that is grand. Other victims of racism, other black people getting a better understanding and having some historical perspective that we have been closing this here gap for 15 years. And exactly, that just doesn't make any sense. Exactly. Follow the logic. Other folks that we have not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Hello.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Good evening. Thank you so much for taking my call. Great clips. I guess some observations were that the Muslim man, he was telling a story about the judge, and I was like, I guess he never noticed that before. I don't know, but I guess I'm glad he's noticed that now. That's been the case for a long, long time. Or maybe he just needed to let it out, like sometimes we need to let it out. I was unfortunately sad to hear about the author passing away. I had never heard of her. And I'm also sad a little bit because I don't know any black people with little kids anymore. But if I do, I have a name now. I know some books to get them started reading. So that was good. I also thought that interview was a little weird because until I guess she said she was biracial, I just knew he was talking to a white person because she just did not seem connected. And it seemed like they just wanted to talk to somebody. Well, let me find some black person or somebody, because it seems like the way the lady described her, if she was just down to earth and friendly, they could have found many a black person to talk about her. And I'm glad that lady called in to explain, oh, I've met her and, you know, all the wonderful things about her. It seems like they could have done that without going to this library, who, VTQ, she's biracial, who never met her. In addition, I don't know how often you watch the late night news, but there was a great example of workplace racism. I guess this white guy on CNN compared Trump to Dr. King, how they were great, and they were doing the same thing in the same way. And all the black people were telling him, no, what is wrong with you? You're crazy, you're crazy. And he just did not care. And he just went on and on. I was like, this is workplace racism at its finest. I don't know if you've seen it. I can send you the clip, because I think it was already online. And that's it for now. If I think of some more, I'll say something else. Thank you.
Awesome. Feel free to email the clip. I will check it out, untiljustice@gmail.com. Other folks that we have not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, line should be open. Did we miss anybody? Because I do see other hands, looks like, folks that we haven't heard from. Anybody that we have not heard from at all? Hopefully people will not lollygag. I will use the moment to get in my other comment really quick. I know we had other folks who had additional commentary as well. That segment from South Africa where they were talking about how they were, I know the guest on that segment, his accent, it was a little thick, which for me over the years, we've talked to so many guests, our Global Sunday Talk on Racism Tomorrow, who have different accents, that it challenges my brain computer to be able to pick up different information from people who don't necessarily sound the same as you. But I thought it was so important because I have spoken about this before, that that is what white supremacy means, that you can be complaining about the police, non-white people, because the police are shooting, killing, strangling, choking, raping all of the black people in that area. Or you could be complaining because there are no police in your area and crime happens and you have to drive 6 hours to go to a police station to make a report. They could do it either way they want. And I know Mr. Fuller, I talked about him and he said with the police, that is, that's what it, he always emphasizes. That's what having an understanding of what white supremacy actually means. We can dominate you in a variety of different ways. We can have all white people, all white police in your area. We can have all black police in your area. We can have all non-white, non-black police in your area. We could have a collage, a little bit of everything. We could have no police in your area. We could try it any way you like, and every way, it's going to still work out where you hate it. It's terrible crime. And as soon as we move you out, we can correct all of those problems instantaneously. That's what white terrorism means. I thought, and particularly for this to be in South Africa, where the whites are hugely outnumbered, exact same issue, just presented in a different way. There, all the police are where the white people are, even where they don't have crime. And I've heard this before on the continent, where they just have armed private police, or like they have their little militia. Any niggers that wander into their area, you might end up getting shot. I've heard that consistently about South Africa. And I think some of that, unless my memory is in error, is in President Obama's Dreams from My Father from the book club. But I'd have to go back to double check. Did we miss anybody? And then we'll, if not, we'll go ahead and get people if they have second comments. Anybody that we missed?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, everyone. Just two short situations.
We can hear you as well. Firefighter, proceed since you were already started, and then we'll get the other caller.
Okay. Yeah, just two incidents down here. Number one, they finally have selected a police chief in the city of Miami Gardens where I reside, non-white black female. I'll just be staying tuned to the daily process on her being the police chief. There've been somewhere around, this is the third police chief in less than a year and a half. So it ought to be interesting. other than that, what was that other incident? For a while now, down here in Dade County Public Schools, the schools that serve in the areas where our children attend less than 2% of the funding, well, the contracts anyway, to repair, build, and things of that nature, maintenance, as far as contracts, less than 2% of the monies that are that's out in the Dade County Public Schools, which is the, I think it's something like the third or the fourth largest school district in the country. Less than 2% of the contracts go to non-white black people, which is a obvious, obviously it's a real devastating thing as far as people being employed who can work and things of that nature. I noticed that at the school where I work at, where there is, I don't see any black people that are, working as far as fixing or doing any, construction anywhere around. And so I'm pretty sure it's that way just about everywhere else. And that's all I have to say for right now. Thank you.
Appreciate that, retired firefighter. I think that was Princess. Were you going to speak?
Can you hear me now?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Hi, guys.
Evening.
I just wanted to share quickly some news that was going on here in Lake County. The other day, they had reported of a shooting at a barbershop. I guess it was a dispute of a customer coming in and wanting a haircut, and the owner had refused to cut the person's hair. And so the person had left and came back later and shot the owner, killed him. And I guess some people, I guess during the melee, had attacked the assailant, and he was critically injured and stuff. And from the news coverage, it looked like this establishment was black owned, and it looked like majority of the clientele was black, maybe Puerto Rican and stuff like that, but mostly black from what I've seen on the news. And I make mention of it only because a caller that had asked, the gentleman that was talking about what, where do black people go next? And as far as how do we go about combating the system, you know, how do we evolve to, like, you know, confronting the problem? I would have to say first, and I know coming from me, from for those of you who know of me, it might be a bit of a stretch, but I'll say it and see where it goes. Say that as black people, we're going to have to start coming to some conclusions about things and being honest with ourselves. And, you know, as far as the situation that we're in. And it's got to be from a place where we have to finally really, really just exhibit self-respect for ourselves and, you know, for us as a people, because this gentleman was killed for a $2 haircut. And I mean, if we can, you know, kill and destroy each other over $2, then I really just don't see us solving this problem at all. That'll be all for now. I had some other stuff, but that was just on my mind because just sad.
Indeed.
I hate my life.
Black self-respect, very important, and practicing nonviolence with other black people. I was thinking about that as we were reading Coretta Scott King's autobiography, the fourth study session coming up next Friday. But the concept, I'd heard it before. I think Charles Cobb, he's been a guest on our program before. He was in SNCC. I suspect he might be mentioned in Mrs. King's autobiography before it concludes. But he mentioned that as well in terms of for all the people who say, I'm not down with nonviolence the way Dr. King talked about and yum, yum, yum. And these white people need, you know, a good bit of counterviolence. Okay. At minimum, we could practice nonviolence with other non-white people, right? That would be, folks shouldn't have too much of a problem with black people saying, hey, I'm going to practice nonviolence with other black people. Like, you know, Princess can get on my nerves all day long, but I'm going to be nonviolent with her, even though she gets on my nerves. Like, everybody, we could agree to that, and I think that would be hugely constructive. And just looking at that as an act of black self-respect, to be nonviolent and try to minimize conflict as best we can with other black people. Appreciate that report from Florida from Princess. Other folks that anybody that we haven't heard from who is with us, anybody who we have not heard from at all who has a hand up? Make sure you don't lollygag if you are here. The number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. We have about 45 minutes remaining. Don't wait till the last moment. Emmy?
Can I give about 5 minutes? I will give me a couple seconds and I will chime back in if I can be heard. 5 minutes.
Resume to shunning. other folks that the caller at 7781, did you have commentary?
Yes. Good evening to everybody. That clip about the car insurance, right now I am paying $280 for my car insurance.
Per month?
Per month.
Wow.
Per month. I was on my mom's car insurance for a little while. But I came off of hers. I wanted to get my own. I wouldn't really have to deal with her financially. And so like $280. But I just got this new job, and I'm supposed after about a certain amount of time on the job, you can go with this insurance company called MetLife, and it's supposed to be like a discount. So I'm holding out for that. I can't wait for that. Also, what I want to talk about, too, was that there's a new movie on Netflix. It's called Wexler, and it's starring Adam Sandler, and it's also starring Jennifer Hudson. And it just screams out racism and white supremacy, you know? I can give a quick synopsis of what it's about. I don't is that okay? Like maybe 3 minutes I can explain, you know.
Oh, that's long for a movie. Like, can you do it in 40 seconds?
40 seconds. Okay, quick. All right, so Adam Sandler is playing this talent finder person, and he had found like 3 people, white men, and they weren't good enough, and so he couldn't really work with them. And so he finds Jennifer Hudson, and she agrees to work with him. She he kind of wins her over by saying this, like one of his most famous lines is, agents are business, but managers are family, you know. And I just thought that was really interesting as well, to look at your talent as business, and then you look at yourself as family, as this is to say that you're money, but I'm good. I'm going to help you. But I just thought I'd put that out there if anybody wanted to check that out. It's experiences throughout the whole entire film. And with that being said, thank you. Keep my line.
For sure. I generally try to not encourage films during the compensatory call-in because I found many victims of white supremacy. We spend a lot of time watching television, maybe more time than we should, Gus included. Reading would be more important than watching television, so I try to discourage that. But there we go. Other folks have commentary that they would like to share, particularly if anybody that we missed. Emmy, did you need more than five, or did you want to speak now?
Unfortunately, I do. Just a couple more minutes.
No problem.
I had a quick question.
Yes, ma'am.
I'm sorry. No, I heard a bit of the discussion about the car insurance. One of the callers said that she has Geico. I was going to ask her, because I have Geico too, and do you have any credit unions that you're members of? Hello?
Oh, are you still with us, ma'am? The female caller who was just talking about that whopping $280 insurance per month. Are you still with us, ma'am?
Oh, yes, I'm here.
Okay.
I'm here. Right now, I am with Progressive. What was her question? What is she asking?
I was asking, do you have any memberships with any credit union?
Yes, I do. I do. It's a small town, credit union, but I do.
In what state do you reside in?
In Georgia.
Well, I don't know what type of car you have, but I have a Honda, and even the most I've never went over $50 a month. For mine. Mine is $47 and some change.
Wow.
But I'm in Florida. Because I had to say, the whole time I was in New Orleans, I kept my stuff, my license and stuff registered in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
I've never, all my cars that I had, well, like I said, they were Honda, because I just like Honda. So maybe that's a factor, too. And I tend to get, even when I purchase another car and stuff, you know, it was through the bank at Navy Federal. But I would always make it a point to, if I get a new used certified car, I try and go anywhere from... Anything over 5 to 7 years, your insurance automatically is going to be, your car insurance tends to be a lot lower. So I have a 2002 Honda Accord. So, but I had gotten it, 3 years ago now? It only recently went up last year, but they were saying because Florida, I guess, had some, they had a lot of hit and runs over the past year and some other stuff going on as far as whatever they say AAA reported as to the reason why mine went up. But on this particular car, since I've had it, my car insurance through Geico was $47 and some odd cents. So now it's like $60 or $62 or something like that.
Did you have a question for her, or I guess a suggestion to help her, maybe something for her to check in on insurance, or you just wanted to let us know?
I was saying, like, if she had any like memberships at banks. I know they say you could get a discount for if you, well, I found out that you couldn't get a discount for Sam's Club, but if you have BJ's, and it's a whole list of, I guess, things that you could probably ask them as far as, like, different discounts that you could get off your, you know, different things and stuff that may help you. But I think mostly you would probably, I don't know.
We're hoping the job will come through. I think she said, I guess there's a grace period or what have you. And then after that, she might be able to get something drastically lower. We will all be hoping that that works out, because that is pretty steep for monthly insurance. Like, wow. Let's see. Any other folks that we missed while we're... Oh, Emmy, I guess, is here. Yes, ma'am.
Okay, I do apologize about that. I was trying very hard to get settled in on the plantation, and the woman was just not leaving to let me chime in, so I apologize about that. I wanted to take a little bit more time to try to gather all my notes because I was driving, but I'll do the best that I can. For the clip regarding the police station in South Africa, I don't remember it being explicitly stated exactly where those funds were coming from and what they were being diverted from, other than there being extra or like a police station in these other areas. That's a lot of money. I mean, I don't really know exactly how it converts over in terms of the currency, so I can really understand how much money it is. But I feel that that money is coming and being diverted from other things that could be more constructive than even police stations in South Africa. I'm not, you know, all that well versed about everything that's going on down there, but I know that that is a considerable amount of money that could be used elsewhere. And so I thought they really avoided kind of getting directly to the point, which I felt I experienced in most of the clips, that in all I kept thinking is there's no way that white people are ignorant about racism. It's just absolutely impossible. It's impossible. And then about the Chinese getting upset in Paris, all I kept hearing while I was listening to that clip is this quote that they repeat whenever they want to talk about the Holocaust. I don't know exactly who said it, but it's like, first they came for such and such, I didn't say anything. Then they came for such and such, I didn't say anything. They went for this other group, I didn't say anything. And then when they came for me, there was nobody to stand for me. And I think, you know, I'm not really sure. I understand the racial hierarchy. I'm glad to have that that term so I can use that effectively when I'm speaking about racism and white supremacy. I'm not so sure where I stand on, like, how do I relate to other non-white, non-black people in the sense, because I feel like that's essentially what's going on. Like, everybody knows there's a problem, but because we exist as black people at the bottom of this hierarchy and we catch it, or excuse me, that might be a metaphor, we experience racism, white supremacy in a worse, visceral way than they do, they're cool. But the minute that they start to feel it, then it's like, well, wait a minute, like, we're the model minority, which I don't know if that's a metaphor. I'm using it as a term because I've heard it before, and it was disgusting when I heard it from another Asian man, because his entire TED Talk was centered around Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech, but then he talks about how he's a model citizen and this implicit bias, and I'm just very frustrated. I'll share that to you. I'm frustrated, and I'm trying really hard not to be bitter, because I think every day I realize more and more that what black means, what it means to be black, what it means to be white, and that I'm not white, which I already knew, of course, like, I'm very brown. I'm not saying that I ever thought I was white, but that all of those things are me. And, like, it's easy when you look outside of the United States to think, oh, man, it's so terrible for non-white black people everywhere in the world. It's really, really, really bad here. To be black is expensive. Like, I don't know. Anyway, so I was going to ask if other people have ever had that, like, weird feeling where it's like, you know, you already knew you were black, but it's like all of a sudden it sets in that you're black and what that means. And, like, it just feels really weird. Like, I don't know how to explain it, because it's not sad. It just feels funny. Anyway, then I did want to comment on the loss of the Black author and just say that even that is kind of giving me anxiety because I feel like we're losing everybody. And I'm not so sure, like, I have enough faith or trust in us right now or the generations coming up. I know we will do it. It will have to happen. But, man, it's just terrifying that the greats are going. And I also didn't know about Prince. I didn't know that he tried to pass off as biracial, but I'm not, that doesn't really surprise me. If you can be anything other than Black, you will be it because it really does suck to be Black under a system of white supremacy. And I, regarding the Muslim judge, immediately when I heard about it, I was like, that's a lynching. However they're doing it now, lynchings can also refine themselves. It doesn't have to be the same way to be considered a lynching. But anyway, I said lynching. But I also thought it was interesting. I don't think that people are negating that she's a Muslim or not mentioning that she's a Muslim because they have a thing against Muslims. I think that people don't really consider American Black people as genuine Muslims. I think that ever since the NOI with Malcolm X, I think there's this idea that they're not genuine Muslims, in which case, whatever, they might have a Muslim name, they might walk around with a hijab, but they're not necessarily real Muslims. So I think that that has something to do with it. If I can think of something else, because I thought I had more to say, but I wasn't able to gather myself, I do appreciate you all's patience and listening to me. Thank you.
For sure. The caller at 4710, 4710. Did you have commentary?
Yes. Hi, Gus and the other callers.
Brittany.
I just wanted to say something. Yes, long time no hear. I just wanted to say something. I was actually arrested maybe, I'm 34 now. I believe I was like 24 at the time for not having my car insurance with me. I got into an accident. I had car insurance, but I was still under my dad's policy and I didn't get the new card, like they would send out a new card every 3 months, and I didn't get that when I had my old card from the previous month or whatever, and I was actually arrested for that. I stayed in jail, I don't know, a few hours, and then I had to go to court, provide my documentation, and then it was dismissed. So I just wanted to mention that. Also, I wanted to mention my family situation. I have a 7-year-old son, and I was over the weekend, me and my mom and my son, we were in the car together driving, and I was like, I'm sick of white people. And my mom was like, oh, don't say that. I love everybody. Your son don't need to hear you say that. You're teaching him the wrong thing. I'm like, I don't hate white people. I don't hate anybody. Like, I don't hate, but I told her, I was like, I'm tired of what's going on. I'm tired of, you know, what I'm experiencing. I'm tired of seeing what white people do to non-white people, Black people, because I don't know what it is to be anybody else. So I'm just, you know, sick of seeing it, seeing Black people, you know, and I explained that to her. I'm sick of seeing Black people act out our pain and frustration on each other, you know, being disrespectful towards each other, killing each other, just doing all these things because we can't do it to them. We don't even know it's them, so we take it out on somebody else because we don't even know really that's the real source. That's who you're really mad at. You think you're mad at, you know, another, your neighbor. And she just couldn't understand that. And today, that was over the weekend. I mean, that was Friday that happened. Today is Saturday. Yeah, that was Friday yesterday. And today she called my sister later this evening and told my sister about the incident. And my sister was like, you know, she pretty much repeated what my mom said. But I told my sister, she's 4 years older than me. I said, I never, you know, told you, I told her the roundabout way, I never told you how to raise your children. Our children are teenagers now, just about 20, you know, much older than my son. And I've never told her or her husband how to raise their kids. So it's like just me mentioning that I'm sick of white people, and which I, you know, it's just like a thought, like I'm sick of white people. Now it's like my family is like, they're upset at me. They're having these counseling sessions with me because I never really discussed with them you know, my views on racism or anything like that. So I'm like, I don't know, like, how to deal with them. Like, now, after this, because now they think, like, I'm teaching my son to hate people because I'm teaching him about racism. Like, after I said that, I explained to him why I said that. So now they think I'm teaching him to hate people and to be, you know, the next Malcolm X or something. So I just wanted to share that. But I'm going to continue doing what I'm doing with my son. And let me just mention that my son, he is biracial, if you want to classify that. He's white. His father is white. I'm African-American. I'm black. He's 7 years old. This happened before I knew much of anything about what I know now. But, you know, like I told my mother, it's my experience. I can't, you know, I'm saying how I feel. But she wants to deny that, seems like she denies that even racism affects her life, you know. So, that's it.
Wowee, Brittany in Louisiana. that right there, well, wait a minute. In fact, before we get to the family thing, the insurance thing, I'm so glad we got that because I was pretty sure it doesn't even have to be that you don't have insurance. It can be that you have insurance paid up, current, you're covered. You just don't have proof that you have insurance, and that can be enough for you to go to jail. That is what magnified my frustration hearing this repeatedly, where non-black, non-white people don't have insurance and are getting in accidents that are their fault, and they're not even being arrested. I mean, that is, you compare that to your situation being 24 and you got to go to jail and you have insurance. Wow. And I mean, that can change your whole life. Just something as small as that. Do I have to go to jail right now or not? That's one. The second part, which you just shared with your family, that's the whole reason that the compensatory call-in exists, because so many listeners, Cal's listeners over the years, have said the exact same thing, that they do not have a source, a person, or people that they can talk to and share their feelings or their views on white supremacy. If they try to tell their family members, unfortunately, sometimes this can even include a parent or whomever else, sibling, spouse, that same response. You hate white people. I can't believe you. I love everybody. Or if you're teaching your children that sort of thing, oh my goodness, you are the worst parent ever. And you're teaching your children to hate white people. And what kind of person are you? And Dr. King would be ashamed. And that exists, like, that is a bit of speech, a bit of racist code. I think we had a guest on the program who talked about deactivate the white chip. That is a metaphor, but that bit of racist programming, I think, is a reflexive response that many victims have anytime you hear a non-white person saying anything that's just logical. And I am perceiving speaking about whites as they are enemies to black people. Whoa, you're not supposed to be talking about that. Let's go to church and we need to do something about that. Right. We need to stop mm-hmm. all of that foul talk that you are spewing. I think a lot of listeners can probably speak to that. The only suggestion that I would have, and I even told this Nancy, she was on the program. She's in Belgium, like yourself, black mom. She's the exact same thing, where her family gave her a stern talking to and shook their fingers in her face. And at almost the exact same thing on the other side of the world, I said, I do not bring up racism around people who express those type of views, who are demonstrating what's been termed racism avoidance disorder, non-Mighty Weeks term, black people, non-white people who just don't want to acknowledge truthfully racism is a problem. They don't want to talk about it. They want to avoid it. I don't agitate them. I don't talk about it. I don't share my views about white people or racism. No problem. I'll keep those views to myself. I might also have to say the same thing that you did. I think that's black self-respect. This is my child. I didn't talk to your sibling. I did not come and lecture you and your husband about what you're doing raising your children. I would expect the same courtesy. I think that's just standard. That's beyond counter-racism. I think that's just parenting. Now that I'm around parents, I think you can just say that, and that should be the end of the discussion for anyone who respects you as a mom, to just say, hey, this is my child. I don't interfere with your parenting. I appreciate your view. Hopefully it'll be the same courtesy in you not interfering or disparaging my parenting with my son. Beyond that, I would just say, yeah, I would not mention I just wouldn't bring up my views about racism around them. And that is a very common problem that I think a lot of listeners have shared over the years on the program. If folks have, I guess, suggestions mm-hmm. that they want to maybe offer Brittany, how they have dealt, because I think a lot of you all have probably dealt with a similar situation, we can nab those as well. Is anybody we missed at all? Anybody that we have not heard from at all? The caller is 6361. Have you heard from you? Last
one. Yeah,
yes, sir.
Awesome. I wanted to say that, this is Ken Steele. I'm currently in Pomona, California. And I wanted to say a couple of things. One, I find it very peculiar that there are people mentioning that nobody is mentioning the religious affiliation of the female judge that was, I believe, that was murdered in New York earlier this week. All of the articles that I read of this situation referred to her as the country's first or only female Muslim judge. In fact, I didn't even know that this was a black person until I saw a version of this headline with the picture associated with it. So I personally, from my observation, I'm seeing that they are downplaying the racial the racial classification of this a victim, and they are playing up the religious affiliation of this victim. And it caused confusion in me. I think it'll cause confusion in others. Rest assured, this is definitely a black female or a non-white classified as black female that was killed or has died in New York, and who was a judge. The same thing occurred earlier in Chicago. This judge, they claim they have a suspect, or the law enforcement officials in Chicago claim that they have a suspect, and the suspect is another victim of racism classified as black. So the news was very quick to push out the narrative that that this was the incident in Chicago was a situation of black on black crime, and the situation in New York. I called it, or I suspected earlier that they would say that this is a suicide, and sure enough, they are giving her the same treatment as they did with Sandra Bland, and it's even down to the say her name memorializing, and it's very frustrating to watch and to see this unfolding, or to see all of these murders occurring, and I don't think that they're getting the amount of attention that they deserve. This to me feels a lot like when the stories of black women being and black children being kidnapped in Washington, D.C., how quickly they were able to debunk those stories and say that they were runaways and say that there was no story to be seen here. And, you know, fast forward a few weeks and you're not hearing any mention of that news. I think they're even associating the missing black girls in Washington, D.C. with they're kind of painting it as they're kind of positioning the story as a hoax in the public dialogue. So all of the suspected racists that were incentivized to comment on it, they were quickly ridiculed by their fellow racist suspects for having done so because of how quickly the story was debunked by so-called liberal news outlets. Also, I wanted to say something really important to victims of racism. As we have been discussing roadside encounters with law enforcement, I was recently in a situation where I was stopped by law enforcement, or rather I was already stopped, and they came up to my car, and the only thing that tipped them off to approach my car was the fact that I was not parked straight. That's what they explained later. But apparently I was parked at this spot for a long time, and it was a 10-minute spot. I didn't know this. In fact, I didn't know that this, you need to be aware of your surroundings, because apparently they were arresting somebody else, and then they saw that I did not move throughout the whole entire arrest affair, and they stopped me. They asked to search my car. I gave them the code. You know, I do not consent to any searches. They asked me, why don't I? I explained that, you know, I just don't see any reason for the search. There's no, you know, I didn't go into too many descriptions, but I finished the sentence with, you know, is there anything I can do to help? And they said, step out of the vehicle. Now, what I will say is this. They told me to put my hands behind my head. And at that point, I thought I was going to be arrested. But really what was going on, I later found out, was they were just testing me. They were seeing how I would react to them attempting to arrest me. They put my hands behind my head, led my hands behind my back, and then they said, we're not going to arrest you. We just want you to sit down right there. And they took my card. They opened my door, and they, you know, did a quick spot check. They didn't find anything suspect. They asked me what I was doing. I presented my business card. I was near the place where I worked. But I was let go. But what I will say is, the thing that kept me safe was the fact that the entire time I remained calm. I think what they're doing is, and what they do is that they scare black men. They will do, or black people in these encounters, and they want to trigger an emotional response. An associate of mine was recently stopped. Yes, an associate of mine was recently stopped, and he gave the police officers or the law enforcement officers the I know my rights routine, and, you know, yelling at them. And that encounter ended with the police officers letting him go. But the law enforcement officers took his ID right there, didn't give it back. And then he had to go through a whole affair with the DMV to get a replacement identification. So these are the kind of tricks that they're playing with victims of racism.
We will leave it there.
Law enforcement officers.
Much thank you, Mr. Steele. Other folks that we have not heard from, the caller at 4683, 4683, did you have commentary? Caller at 4683, did you have commentary? You just listening? I would assume they are just listening. Did we miss anybody? Anybody that we have with us that we have not heard from at all? We have about 10 minutes left in the broadcast. Anybody that we missed? The caller at 2425. 2425, did you have commentary?
Yes, may I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, greetings, guests, and to the rest of the callers. So I'm pretty sure a lot of you know about how Trump launched the mother of all bombs. It's in Syria, and it's brought up a whole bunch of tension in my area especially, and a lot of people are coming up with the conclusion that, oh, we're just going to go into another world war. And I just said, oh, well, we were already going to go into a war with this man in the office no time soon, but not surprisingly, that it's only been 3 months in since he was just basically the president, and he decided to do this. I remember I saw on social media this speech he made about another bombing that he did, where the bomb basically affected like many females and many children, and he just was apologetic about it. But what I don't understand about it is, how can you be apologetic but you still did it? You're not apologetic, you're just showing off for these people. So they can think you're a good person. You're really not. You're really not a good person. And I remember somebody saying, oh, we're probably just gonna all die just by, like, we're probably just all gonna die. There's probably gonna be another world just based on, like, the fire that's gonna be sort of like nuclear weapons and stuff just being bombed all over the place. But I wouldn't say I feel bad for the Syrians, but I just notice what's going on, because I don't, like, I could say that I could feel bad for something, but there's nothing I can do about it. So there's no way I can solve this. I can't really feel bad for it, but I notice it. That's what I can say. But yeah, I just feel like it was kind of a unnecessary move for Trump to do that, because basically, like I said, he dropped the mother of all bombs to Syria. I don't know why, but I feel like there's a reason that it's not going to be backed up too far, because there was, in my opinion, there's no reason to do it. But I guess that's Donald J. Trump, so I can't really say anything about it. But we've been discussing it all over school, like, what's going to happen? Are we going to go into war? Who's going to be drafted? I remember somebody said, oh, you might be drafted as a 16-year-old black male, because they will go to that risk if they need to. But I just can't deny you, because why would they draft me with all the middle-aged people all over the country? But that's all I wanted to share. Thank you for taking my call.
For sure. Grand to hear. This is our young male caller in the Bay Area, sounding a little stuffy. I hope you're taking good care of yourself. But that rhetorical ethic, I think Dr. Marimba Ani's term, whites are phenomenal at that, to give the appearance that they feel bad about something, especially if something involving non-white people being harmed. And that's not the case at all. They just do a lot of that just to give the presentation that they are concerned. We miss anybody? Anybody have a hand up that we have not heard from at all last, like, 9 minutes of the broadcast, just making sure we haven't missed anyone who did have commentary? Did we miss anyone? Assuming that we nabbed all of our callers. Outstanding. Did anybody have any additional commentary that they wanted to get in? You'd have to be brief, because I think there were a few folks who said they had commentary, so you can take like max 60 seconds to get any additional thoughts you want to share. Anyone else?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Gus, I wanted to ask if you saw the documentary that I sent you the link for on Screaming Jay Hawkins.
I have not seen it yet. No, sir.
Okay, I just want to tell everybody there's a documentary on Screaming Jay Hawkins. He's what they call the father of shock rock. And his most famous song is a song called I Put a Spell on You, which is the song that DJ Premier sampled for Biggie, Kicking the Door. His story is extremely fascinating and is so riddled with white supremacy. It's incredible. And I'll just implore everyone to look at it. You can find it on YouTube. It's about 1 hour and 49 minutes. Man, it's just mind-blowing. And I had no idea. They have another documentary on him, which discusses the fact that he had at least 57 kids that they know about. Blew my mind. I'll just say, check it out. It's incredible. Thank you. And I'll eat my line.
Much obliged. Other folks have additional commentary they wanted to add in?
Yes.
We can hear you, retired firefighter.
You want me to go now? Or?
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Okay. Yes. In reference to the non-white victim of racist white supremacy early in the program, I think she was asking for suggestions in regards to the communication from, I think it was a parent that mentioned about that you may be teaching your child hate. My suggestion would be you probably need to set more laws of engagement with people. I believe when Mr. Fuller was talking about that, he did not limit it to just people who are considered to be associates. I think he also meant for close, quote-unquote, family members also. rules of engagement on when you're going to verbally communicate or be in the presence of that person. You set the rules on when and where you want that to happen, and that will cut out a lot of that type of negative engagement, almost 100%, actually. If you control that, as far as quote-unquote days where it's supposed to be designed to go over to somebody's house, well, you may not choose to do that. To just set that yourself. I would say one thing, the issue of racism does come up a lot. And when it does come up and you're asked something, you may want to engage, but that's up to you. And so that's all I want to say. Just, you know, set more rules of engagement on what you're going to say, what you're not going to say, what you're going to do and what you're not going to do around anybody. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other folks that we missed or any other folks have commentary they wanted to get in before we get ready to conclude things?
Yeah, just real quick, the young caller from, I believe, San Francisco, just to correct, the Moab, or mother of all bombs, that was dropped in Afghanistan, not in Syria, Afghanistan. And also, I heard from a military mother this week that her son is set to deploy to Syria, who is a Marine, is set to deploy to Syria on Monday. So I don't know if they've announced that they're putting boots on the ground, but it sounds like they are upping the troop numbers in Syria.
Appreciate that. Right on, Mr. Steele. Any folks have additional commentary they wanted to make sure they got in? You have about 5 minutes left.
Hello?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call again. Recently at work, I went to a forum on diversity. They always have these things, and I'm new, so I want to hear what they have to say. And it's about teaching social justice and education to future educators that work at a university. And so I asked them, I said, well, this social justice stuff is great, wonderful, blah, 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 but how will you turn this into legal justice for the students in the classroom? Because most of you are going to teach in public schools, and we know now most of the public schools are filled with non-white children. And pretty much crickets, no real answer, nothing to say. And then I guess they got a little upset because I said, I thank God I don't have children, because if I did, I would not send them to these schools with you all in them to terrorize my children. Thank you.
I know they did not appreciate that. Wow. Wowee. And whites, they are infamous. They are dependable for those types of shenanigans where they have diversity training, sensitivity training, all of this, again, to give the appearance that, hey, we are not racist, or if we are racist, we're going to take about 5 classes and we're going to have that all done the next 30 minutes. So they are great at that sort of thing. And I mean, that right there, just asking questions can reveal the phoniness of all of that. So great job. I know they were upset with you. Other folks have commentary that they wanted to make sure they get in? Any other commentary? Folks want to make sure they get in. Last couple minutes before we wrap up.
Gus, speaking of AI, I wanted to ask if you had seen the article that that Russia had put out in regards to the RoboCop police officer robot they have that literally walks on two legs. It has two hands and it holds two guns. And from what I understand, it shoots quite terrifyingly accurate. I don't know if you might have come across that, since I know you've been doing more research on artificial intelligence. I want to know if you saw that.
I have not seen this. This is a Russian robot or Russian report. I have not seen that, although it doesn't surprise me. I know they have been talking about different uses of this sort of technology with enforcement departments. Nothing that advanced. I hadn't heard anything about basically some sort of Terminator cop type thing that's going out armed with guns in the States.
I'm going to send you the article on that. And also there's a video on Japanese sex robots. And I'll send you that, too. It's a YouTube video. It's about, I think, 20-something minutes long, where it basically details literally these lifelike robots with, I guess it's rubber, but they look like human skin. They talk to you. They can help do things around the house. You can have sex with them. And also they discuss how people in Japan are lonely because they have one of the highest population of elderly people as far as per country on the planet. And because these people are older, they're looking for companionship, and that these robots also give them companionship. My son was blown away when I sent it to him. So I'll send you the link for that and the link for the RoboCop psycho robot that they're about to unleash shortly, okay? Thank you.
Appreciate that. I am not surprised. All sorts of ghoulish technology used to strengthen the system of white supremacy. We should be here tomorrow. Remind folks, Global Sunday Talk on Racism. It'll be 3 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Central, 12 noon Pacific. We should have listeners, non-white people from a variety of different locations on the planet to discuss racism, white supremacy. Certainly we can catch up with the strike, get some of their views on what has been happening with the Trump administration happening stateside. We'll be grand to check in with our listeners, different spots on the globe. That'll be tomorrow, earlier broadcast time. Anything else quickly? Folks wanted to make sure they get in before we conclude. I will assume folks are satisfied. I will say with the whole clip on, the clip as it was titled was A Return to the War on Drugs. I remember back in 2012, right at the beginning of 2013, right after they legalized cannabis in Washington State, where I am, and in Colorado State, and people were talking about, you know, hey, there's a big push, and are white people going to legalize? I absolutely still think that is going to happen. I think Canada moved forward this week with legalizing cannabis nationally, recreational cannabis. I don't think they did it formally, but I think they have moved forward in that direction. I had to go back to double check. But that took place. I think there's still going to be many, many, many more states, particularly, I think, not this year, but I think next November when they have the midterm elections, I suspect there'll be more states that will vote to legalize recreational cannabis then. And I think it'll be even more by the time we get to 2020. We have Trump will be up for reelection. I think they can do that. And you can still have all of these policies where black people get locked up for no insurance or whatever. You are out smoking or anything. They will still find ways, reasons to have tons of black people in cages. I said that way back in 2013. They can legalize cannabis. I said then I do not see white people going out of the business of locking up niggers. I do not see any evidence of that now. They can have legal cannabis and still have tons of black people in jail. And all that rhetoric that they've spewed for the last, I think it's been a good 7-8 years of cannabis and the war on drugs is going to be like Jim Crow and lynching and rah, 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 and all of this, all of that, and we will be no further. We will have made no progress, to borrow karma. We will have made not even a dent, excuse the metaphor, in racial disparity with sentencing or incarceration. We won't have made any progress at all. It'll have been 15, 20 years of talk, running off at the mouth and doing all this, and we're still in the exact same spot. That's about what I would expect to happen. Anywho, we will be here tomorrow, Global Sunday Talk on Racism. Looking forward to it. I think it is very important, thinking of racism, white supremacy as a global problem, and sharing information, views with victims in different parts of the world. Everybody can learn a little more. So we'll be here about 12 hours. Huge thanks to all the folks for participating, calling in this evening. I hope it was a constructive investment of your Saturday evening. If you're doing Easter festivities and all of that tomorrow, I guess make it constructive. I'm sure we got some folks who will have to participate in some way, shape, or form. I hope you can minimize conflict if you are with family and friends and all of that. Don't have any brawls break out over the Easter egg hunts. If you are outside, I will say the same thing. Sobriety would be best. I didn't hear commentary to the person's question. How do we deal with these disparities? My view is understanding racism, white supremacy. White people have the power to decide that they're going to lock black people up, whether you committed a crime or not, or we're going to punish you more for the exact same crime. They have the power to do that in all areas of activity. So one thing that we do have the ability to control, I can, to the best of my ability, say that I'm going to make sure that you do not have the opportunity to hit me with any of those massive sentences for drugs, because I'm going to be practicing sobriety. That's, I think, almost exactly what Dr. Welsing recommended on this here program some years back, that that's how we deal with the whole drug problem, not waiting on Jeff Sessions or Donald Trump to change their mind and say we're not going to lock up niggers anymore. No, to say we're under a system of racism, white supremacy, and this is one thing that I can do that will help neutralize some of your racist anti-black plans. I am going to be sober. I'm going to make sure that my brain computer is functioning at maximum efficiency so I can think of solutions, concepts to permanently end the system of white supremacy. That is what Dr. Welsing would encourage and recommend. Dr. Cambon, Mr. Fuller, Dr. Amos Wilson. I think I could get a pretty lengthy list of folks who would co-sign on that and say, right on, whatever you're going to do with the free time this weekend and warmer weather, make sobriety a part of it. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. I stated myself, you get stopped by enforcement officials and they ask you to search your person or your vehicle. I know you're just doing your job. I do not consent to searches of my person, my property, my vehicle without a warrant, with a smile, calmly. Kyle signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Man, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.